Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of the Carpcast. A belated hello, we're late, aren't we, again?
Yeah, we've got to apologise to people, but it's just been one of those weekends where time has not been on our side, and, you know, when I've been ready to do it, Jamie hasn't, and when Jamie's been ready, I haven't, so better late than never.
Yeah, it's all kind of come from the hectic weekend we had at the Northern Angling Show. That's for those that don't know, we've been hammering it on here for weeks and weeks, but it's a show that I'm involved with, held in Manchester at Event City, and it was last weekend, so kind of all the everything was geared up towards that. We did a live interview with Frank Warwick on the stage on the Sunday. I hosted the stage on Sunday, and well, before I go into it, how would you sum the show up, Mark?
Epic, busy, rewarding, tiring. All in one.
It's a long weekend. Obviously, you were working on the Carpcast stand all weekend, so you were pretty. You know, you're in there from 8 till 5 every day. It's just walking about. I mean, I have a health app on my iPhone, and if you put that on, it tells you how much you've been walking. I was doing like 12 miles a day on the setup days. 12 miles a day for somebody that's 2 stone overweight and you know, has not done much physical exercise. I haven't fished much in the last 2 years, which means we're not pushing a barra twice, 3-4 times a week, you know, to and from a swim, which is generally all the exercise I used to get. All of a sudden going into like 12 miles a day, and it's quite intense because in those exhibition centres, the floors are rock hard. When I say rock hard, it's like the highest grade steel you can get, because, I mean, they have to be able to take everything, like fairground rides going on them, and, you know, you name it. They have to be geared up for it. So we learned in year one of the show, like, you have to buy special, you know, like Air Max trainers and stuff. Otherwise, the backs of the legs, your ass, everything is just aching after, like, the first day. When you've got, like, 4 days in there.
What you need is a Segway.
A Segway, yeah.
A Segway to fly around on.
Yeah, without a doubt. Although I kind of like the exercise. I feel a bit better this week. You know, I'm motivated to keep it up. Whether I'll actually get to the gym, I don't know. But I'm motivated to keep it up. But yeah, the show was epic. We had around 10,000, maybe slightly more. We still haven't done the... totted up all the complimentary tickets, and the, you know, the kids were free in there, and we got a glowing review in the Daily Mirror, National Press, from Julian Cundiff did a report on it. And it's interesting to see somebody else's point of view who's unconnected with the show, because he basically said it felt like a rock concert when people were streaming in. He said it felt like
a mosh pit.
Said it felt like more than 10,000 people. But the main thing that blew him away was the amount of people that had never been to a show before, and the amount of families that were there, which is kind of what we've aimed to do, you know, by doing the family tickets. If a family ticket, I mean, we might change it for next year, but a family ticket was actually cheaper than two adult tickets. So, you know, if you were going with your mate, it was actually cheaper for you to buy a family ticket. It obviously worked. It obviously encouraged families, because, like I say, Jules said that he was taking pictures all day long. He was really impressed at the amount of young kids there and families. And that for us is great. Obviously, it's a business, and we had a successful show. But, you know, we like to think it's not just about trying to make some money. If it was about making some money, we'd have given the show up 3 years ago, because we lost 20-something grand the first year. You know, we still owed 7 grand after the second year. We broke even the third year, and it's the first year where that should get something back for it. So, all in all, it was a fantastic weekend, but, like I say, tiring. I'm kind of just recovering now, week and a half afterwards, and with the run up to the show, everything's built up. I mean, you're out fishing now, aren't you? You're actually sat on a lake. We might be able to recreate the Adam Penning episode.
Yeah, I'll to do a penning. I'll turn my receiver up just in case.
It'd be even nicer if you do get a bite on there. There's a reasonable chance it could be a very special fish, you know, 40 pound plus carp, maybe even a 50. Tell the listeners where you are.
Yeah, I'm on Swan Lake on the Bluebell Complex. It's my first visit down here, and I'm quite impressed with it. You know, nice clear water. I do like clear lakes. A lot of people don't, but I do. And there's mid-50s in here. Well, a mid-50 called Dave Zedfish, which by all accounts is not a very regular visitor to the bank. I believe that's just over 50. Another common, which is roundabouts there, which I've just seen pictures of, and it's the same fella. I forgot his name now, but that fella will be a Cromwell of spanking. I've seen pictures of him with it at 47 something.
Oh yeah, Nigel Ramspot on the thing.
Yeah, that's him. I don't know. Don't know how many 40s or estimate of 30s are in, but and it's a good stock of fish. And well, it's not the cheapest ticket that we covered the other day in the fishery top trumps, but is I'm thinking it's well worth it.
Certainly, I said to you yesterday. The way I look at day ticket fishing, I mean, I've always had a syndicate ticket for a lot of years, and I kind of look down on day tickets. As in, why would you go and pay 25 quid a day, 30, well, you know, the dearer now these days, but back then they were 25 quid, 24 quid a day. And I actually thought about it. I thought, if I'm fishing a syndicate, I'd be lucky to get 8 sessions in a year, as a rule, you know, pick and time your new moons, pick and time your decent periods, get 3 or 4 sessions in a row in the spring, and maybe the same in the autumn. I never fish in the summer, I never fish in school holidays. So I'm going to do, like, let's say I do 8 3-night sessions and let's say I'm fishing somewhere like Bluebell at 30 quid a night. So that's 120 quid a week times 8. It's basically a grand. Now, any decent syndicate's going to cost you 600 quid plus. So it's not a lot different. And there's some, you know, and I think the Bluebell ticket is a grand, isn't it, for the year?
I believe so, yeah.
Lynch Hill Complex is like 750, 800 quid. You know, there's a lot around the 800 quid to £1,000 mark. And if you're only going to do like 8 3-night sessions a year anyway, which is no matter how much I think I'm going to fish, that's usually what ends up happening by the end of the year. So, I mean, it's no different. You've got problems fishing day ticket lakes all year round, obviously. Because of the busyness of day ticket lakes, and sometimes the types of angler that you get can be frustrating. You know, you get people tipping up at
3 tranny vans in my eye line at the minute.
Yeah, and you get, I fish in a van, that don't mean anything, but you know, like when people tip up on day tickets, you know, you might have everything set and a peg and you've got your space around you, and 5 a.m. somebody tips up in the next peg and starts spotting a marker in. You know, it's like you've just wasted a morning pretty much, because of the extra disturbance, and that tends to happen less on syndicates, so you've got to factor that in.
Yeah, that was my landing net falling over on a gust of wind.
Nice. So yeah, but
no, they get excited.
Day tickets are something to look at. I don't know, I fancy Bluebell myself this year. What a stock there is in that lake. You must have a buzz sat there now.
Oh, I have, knowing that there's, not just like one, but probably, you know, definitely three, and maybe one or two other fish above my current PB, or personal biggest. So, yeah, I've got, it's smaller than what I expected, to be honest. And, you know, I think, the swims might be a bit too close together, but it's a day ticket gaff, it is what it is. It's a business, and, yeah, I'm quite happy to pay my dues, because... Yeah, I've been thinking when we had the conversation the other day, I'm going to keep my Icon ticket just because it's my little bit of sanctuary. And I'll go there when I get fed up of this. But when we've got us, you know, with socials and other things, and, you know, hopefully getting out on the bank and interviewing people, that's going to take up his fishing time, it's handy not to waste, you know, 600-700 quid or more on a syndicate and bob down there for his big fish fix when we need it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I said when I did a Carp TV on there, carp-tv.com. Check out Joe Morgan and the guys. Yeah, it's a fantastic thing. But I did one in December, and we went on there, and I ended up losing a couple of fish on Ziggs, and I got the buzz for the place. In fact, fishing there probably sparked my my little. What's happening there?
Mega drop back.
You on a zig?
No. There's no birds.
You gotta pick it up then.
Ooh. Yeah, I just did nothing there.
Wow. Sure there's no birds around.
That's in about 10 foot. There's a mallard at the bank, but mallards are down that deep. They do dive on here, I've seen them. Oh yeah, shit rig. Tubing's blown right back.
Been done?
Yeah, been done.
Wow.
Oh well, next. I'm just going to wrap this up and get it straight back out.
Alright, I'll pause the recording because it's too windy anyway for you to talk. Ironically, one of our listeners' questions today is about how to tie rigs. I think I best answer this one, eh, Mark? Pow, pow,
shots fired! Yeah, I think you'd better, mate. I'm just, I've printed it down to a tench. I only do a tench. I land every carp that comes round. I'll try and convince myself of that anyway.
Describe the peg you're fishing in. Like, where was that spot? What? Paint the scene for us. Let's tell us what happened.
Oh, the scene, the swim, that spot, it's on the, I'm casting, I mean, like a corner, it's the first swim, it's probably got a name, but I haven't got a clue what it is. But I'm probably feeling around about 9-10 foot down, it's like a gravelly bump. You go any further up to the margin and you're getting a lot of, like, twigs and branches, which are probably blown over there over the winter. So if you've got a bit of woodland around you. This is me right, yeah. If you've got a bit of woodland around your lake, you might have one or two new snags up here. But
yeah.
easy chuck, 12 and a half wraps, it's back out now. And what I've been doing with that, I've been, about every spot, every 20 minutes, half an hour, it's been getting one spot full of bait. You know, just keep it trickling in on like a little and often basis rather than the usual copy tactic of, that we all do. I put a big lump on and sit and wait on it. Because I'm a big believer that using noise is an attractor as well. Let the carp's curiosity to the constant splosh get them
in. I completely
in.
Agree. We've spoke about this before with, you know, the way Kev Hewitt and that Nigel fishes on Cromwell. I mean, they both have one thing in common. They both fish multiple rods on the same spot and they feed it constantly throughout the session, day and night. And, you know, it's the match tactics we spoke about on the Kev Hewitt interview a few shows ago.
Yeah.
And yeah, it does definitely seem to work. Definitely seems to work on stock lakes.
Yeah, I was looking on my phone last night at some pictures of fish for me that I can find. I found Kev Hewitt's picture of Dave, and it's from this swim.
Yeah, it is.
So that'll give me put a little wry smile on my face, thinking it'd be nice to get lucky and never come back, one and done. But that doesn't happen to me, that one.
What about 1-0?
Oh yeah, no, 0-1.
Yeah, you've just on lost it, like I did in December. We've both lost it now.
Yeah, no, that one, Dave. Unless it's his mate, Dave the Tench. Little Dave.
You reckon?
But no. Yeah, speaking of losing, totally different top, but have you watched Anderson Silva and Bisping yet?
I haven't watched it, no. Yeah, I heard it, well, I saw your post.
I can't even talk to you about it then, can I?
I saw your post.
I've not told you Bisping won. I just put wow. I never said who won.
All right. Yeah, so, did you not put and Silver was robbed?
No. I just put just watched Bisping versus Silver. Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't give anything away, but wow.
Yeah, it must have been somebody else in the same bit of news feed that I read was like, Silver got robbed. I was like, all right, I'm not going to watch that then.
I actually spent some money and got the UFC Fight Pass to watch it. Ooh, that's just that rod I've just recast tightening up. You know, I'm sat here now. I'm like a coiled cobra ready to pounce.
So, I mean, you're fishing to the right towards a margin. You're in that situation, when you're fishing a corner towards like the right-hand margin or left-hand corner towards the left-hand margin, quite often bites are dropbacks because the fish come away from the margin. So it's very common.
Oh, yeah, they can't go too far away from you.
No, it's very common to get dropbacks fishing at that type of angle, like a 45-degree angle into a margin. Yeah, I've done it loads of times. It's cost me fish as well, because there are certain buzzers that will remain nameless, but they don't function very well when they're at that type of angle. You sometimes just get a single beep. And like say, if you're in the next swim, you're chatting to your mate or something, you don't always know that, you know, and you pick the rod up and the fish has gone 40 yards the other way, like across your peg. I've definitely had that.
It's definitely come from fish. Yeah, it was happened to me once on St. Ives. It's drop your leads 20 further shorter than what you actually cast it.
Yeah, I lost.
I blame Langley over a bit of candy floss surface weed for that one, not the actual buzzer, but still, it's all part of the learning curve we're on.
I had one on. I lost the power station on Nash's Church
on
Lake.
Quite
a few years ago. I was actually moving peg. So it wasn't the buzzer's fault, it was my fault. All I'd had a few takes. I had the big common out of there as well at 48 on that session. I had quite a lot of fish, all 20s and then one big and the common. I had about 6 20s in a row. And then I was moving pegs to a different spot that I'd start picking fish up, and I'd just left that one rod in the corner while I was moving. And I'd just set the bibby up. It's only a small lake, so I was only like round the corner, you know, it's not too far away, but... got a single beep, and quite a few of the bites had done that. I got a single beep, and then where they'd come off the reeds, I'd pick the fish up to the right. Anyway, that happened, and I thought, I listened for it. Quite often they beep like a second time. I'd normally just go, you know, run into the rod. It didn't beep again. It was only the one beep, and when I went back round there to get the last bit of gear. I could see that I'd had a bite, picked the rod up, and it had come back on itself, then gone back into the reeds, in behind the reeds, round a corner. And so I got that there's boats on there, so I got a little dinghy to go out and see if the fish was still on, and I could see it there, just sat in the reeds. It was the power station, which was, you know, fish anywhere between, it's been 46 pounds to 54 pounds at its biggest weight. It's a very dark, it's like a brown fish, it looks like. I'd seen it showing over the spot the day before, three or four times, seen it poke its head out up to me, because it's only like, I'm talking 15 yards out, if that. I'd seen it show anyway, the fish had stopped showing. I started picking fish up on a different area, so I was moving. And anyway, it was that fish. I could see it there, my rig hanging out of its mouth in the reeds. But I couldn't, it was in the reeds, just on the surface with its back. And I actually touched its back. I was like, how do I get this fish out of here? Like, I was still attached to it, but the line was going sort of in the reeds and then at a right angle to the left.
Like a knit one, pearl one.
Yeah, so I was like, so I couldn't pull it out because it would have pulled it right, kind of like more into the reeds, the way the line was going. And so I was like, I tried to get the net in the reeds to just scoop it, because it was just sat there. I could see like a fish that might have been 50 pounds. And I couldn't get the net in the reeds, so I turned the net on its side to try and like slide it in between the reeds. I couldn't do it. So then I thought, right, what I'll do is I'll grab the rig in... like where the lead clip is, like I'll unclip the clip that the lead clip's on. You know, I use sticks when I cast out, so I use like a little hook link clip. So I thought I'll unclip the hook link clip so that I can just then guide the fish out of the reeds. I'll just like hold the swivel or you know, the actual figure of eight loop and just pull the fish out. So I managed to get the rig off, but bear in mind my hand is like 4 inches from the fish's face, and the fish had just sat there. I thought, like, I'll just like guide it out by hand, and I managed to unclip the rig, and just as I started to pull the fish's head round, the hook just plopped out the mouth, so I'm sat there with the rig in my hand, and the fish just sat there. It didn't move. I was just looking at it. Bearing in mind, I'm like, you know, I'm in a boat that's...
Eat it like a scoop.
The wind's blown it. I couldn't scoop it because I couldn't get the net in the reeds. It's like, imagine it's like facing away from me with its head like the length of the fish into the reeds, and its tail's probably level with the edge of the reeds. It's just sat there. And like, oh, so now there's no rig or anything in its mouth. I'm like, I had one stab at it with the net, couldn't get it in there, and it just slowly slid down. Like, I don't even know if it knew it was free. It just dropped really slowly. I was like, shit.
Yeah, that's not bad. It's on Nashes as well, isn't it? So
yeah, but that's why it just dropped out. When it must have just pulled it at a different angle, and it just fell out. I was just like, wow. There we go. Could have been an epic session, that two of the best fish in the lake. But it's still a good session.
Yeah,
anyway.
So you still can't complain of that common.
No, it was a fantastic fish. That common's been a good 50 since then. Yeah. But should we... there's loads of stuff on here. I said let's do a fairly quick one because we're going to have another podcast out in just a few days' time. So let's move along fast. And we've already chatted for half an hour without actually getting past line one of the planner. Of a two or three page planner. A three page, a four page planner.
There's quite a bit on it, but always good to have content. Should we pay the bills?
Yeah, we'll pay the bills. We were going to talk, something else I wanted to mention about the Northern Angling Show was Matt Hayes and Mick Brown. But I would like to go in depth on that. There's a few things they said that I really didn't agree with. So I do want to cover it properly. Let's do that on the Saturday show. This is going to be coming out Tuesday evening. Let's maybe move on to that one. So, dnabaits.com. www.dnabaits.com. You can get extra discount off all their post-free deals and anything that's on their website. You can go to the website, buy gear direct. And I know you've been looking quite seriously at the DNA stuff recently, haven't you, Mark? I think you're considering making it your main bait company.
It may be. That's whatever occurrence I've just had on me right. And Rod was on a little DNA wafter. I don't want to say wafter, that's perfectly incorrect. A little wafter.
They do some great stuff. I mean, it's a couple of my friends, you know, good anglers. One of them was on the latest Carpcast Extra, Roger Bacon, on the In Session. He had a good sort of 9-10 fish, which was all on the Secret S7.
Seven.
The S7.
I know, because I've already phoned him up to pick his brains.
Yeah, you rang him, didn't you, to get his honest opinion of the bait, and I think you're preparing to... make moves to go on it yourself now. So I mean, we cannot endorse it any better than that. And they do some fantastic deals. They've supported the Carpcast since the off. They do loads of post-free boily deals. You get you can have either like 5 kilos, 10 kilos, 20 kilos, 50 kilos, and with those you get you pick your choice of boily, like Secret 7, the Nutter S, the SLK, the Ocean X, and I think the Switch is coming out now. It's launched at the Northern Angling Show. But with that, you get a boiler of your choice, and you get 3 kilo of matching pellets or stick mix. You get a tub of pop ups or wafters as well, and 250ml of bait soak. And they're all post free to your door. $59.99 for the 5 kilo deal, $94.99 for the 10 kilo deal, $149.99 for the 20 kilo deal. They're post free, and if you use the code CARPCAST5 at the checkout, you get an extra 5% discount off everything. They do loads of other stuff. They do a Zig deal where you get 2.5 kilo spod mix, bottle of sticky sweet liquid dip that everybody raves about, and you get some Fox Zig aligners as well. It's only £30 post free, and again you can get an extra 5% discount. Go to their website www.dnabaits.com and check out all their stuff, and I'm pretty sure you're going to be getting weekly reviews, because Mark and I both got our fishing heads on this year, and Mark's going to be using DNA, I think, if he can sort a deal out with Jason, who we had on the show a little while ago. I'm sure he's listening to this, but I think Mark's extremely keen to get involved somehow. They do a fluoro pop-up deal as well this winter, all year round, I'm guessing, but fluoro pop-ups are ideal in the winter. As you're going to hear from the Frank Warwick interview that's coming up in a little bit, Frank goes quite in-depth about bait. We wanted a load of Frank's stories, really, but we did a load of stories at the Northern Anglia show when we interviewed him, and we've got a load of his stories on tape that we're using in the Carpcast Extra. But when I interviewed him this week for this show, we ended up going deep on bait, and that's the beauty of this podcast, is we kind of go where the conversation takes us, and it happened to be a very technical interview about bait. So we will get him back again for stories. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I didn't cover any of the stuff I wanted to talk about with him, but it ended up being a really good interview, or I think it was. You know, I learned a lot from it. But one of the things we were talking about was the fluoro pop-ups and how they work, why they work. And I know DNA Baits do a fluoro pop-up deal, 5 tubs of them. It's £25. It's post free to your door. And again, use the code CARPCAST5 when you check out in the box, and you get an extra 5% discount on that. Let's move on there. Place, me and you are going into 4 weeks, in 4 weeks' time, Mark. We're going to have a little French fishing holiday, aren't we?
We are now. French accent, do it.
What's my? Moi rigs will work better than yours because you are nutty.
Sorry
for being a bit racist to the French there. Christophe, who will be listening to this, who's one of the co-owners of the lake, him and Lee own this particular lake, and he is French, so I'm sorry if I offended him, but he doesn't sound very French, so yeah, it sounds like he's from down south, because he is. But yeah, it's a fantastic lake. It's 4.5 acre spring-fed lake. Fish are growing really well. It's well stocked. It's fish to upper 40s, scraper 50s. I'm hoping they're 50 by the time we get there. I know our friend Roger Bacon went there last year and had a few 40s and lots of action. But the beauty of this lake is you get a 4-bedroomed farmhouse with the lake. And which means you can have, take 2 families, really, and £850 carp cast offer for the week for 2 families and your own private lake stuffed full of fish is a ridiculous deal. There are a few weeks left this year, and Mark and I are going to do a carp cast live from there, and I think Christoph's going to meet us over there as well, and Lee, and they're going to do a bit of chat. There are loads of fish over £40. There's hundreds of fish over 20, and this is only a 4.5 acre lake. They're all gaining weight. You get a 170-year-old farmhouse just up the road, 400 metres away from the lake. There's 4 big double bedrooms, shower, toilet, big open plan farmhouse kitchen, gas oven, hob, fridge, freezer, microwave. There's a bait freezer. There's particle boiling equipment. There's a big barn with games and stuff in, table tennis tables and all sorts of, it's a great place for a family holiday, and there's like satellite TV, big leather sofas. It looks really nice, and we will be reporting from there in about 4 weeks' time, roughly, hoping the weather's nice and warm by then. We can get a bit of end of March sun. Yeah, but yeah, I'm really looking forward to going. If you're interested in going, then you can get hold of Lee on his UK mobile, 07854 857 374. Or Christoph, give him a call, 07428 183 018. It's saintamandleisure.com. www.saintamandleisure.com. There's a drone video of the whole beautiful little French village that it's in. On our Facebook page. It might be a little way down, we'll have to bump it up, but you can see how beautiful the lake is, you can see the house, you can see the little French village that it's in, and it's just a really nice place and a really cheap holiday. Take 2 families out there, get 4 or 5 people on the lake, you can sleep 8 people in the house. You'd be mad not to. I tell you, as somebody we saw at the fishing show, Mark, I know he gave you a few tubs of hook baits, and that was bespoke baits, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were neighbours at the show, and quite interesting stuff they do. If you've not heard of bespoke baits, I'll just tell you a bit about Martin, the fellow who does it, because it's not just another you know, Facebook company that's cropped up out of nowhere. You know, he's an educated chap, level 2 angling coach. He's been a fish farmer. He's a qualified diver as well. And, you know, he's been around catfish for a long time. He knows what he's doing. So what they do is he's hook baits. They're all using nature's shapes. That's their little slogan. They've got little barrel grubs, cocoons, mini cocoons, striped caterpillar slugs, pop-ups, wafters, bottom baits, several flavours. I know you wanted some of the green-lit mussel ones, but I think they sold out there. But, yeah. You know, your cell, your hybrid, your nutcracker are all there. You know, perfect for singles, perfect for stalking, he was telling me as well. And I've got some in my hand now, is winter fruit pop-ups. And, you know, I was thinking about them. For somewhere like, you know, somewhere like Aiken, where I've been fishing, you know, useless. Somewhere like this, where come the summer, these fish are going to be uber-pressured. A different shape hook bait, you know, it can be something that makes a bit of difference, can't it? You know, they're going to see so many round balls, and something that bit different, you know, it can make the difference. I wonder if Dave likes one. What do you reckon?
have you got some on, have you? He gave me a few tubs to have a look at, and like I say, I really like the shapes of them. They are, they're basically pop-ups, come in normal pop-up tubs, but they're the shapes of grubs and caterpillars, and, you know, they're like stripy colours. They look very interesting. I really like the green lit mussel ones, and like I say, he didn't have any of them. He's given me some of the cell ones and some pineapple ones. I think some of them are wafters, some of them are pop-ups, some of them balance baits, but they look different. And as somebody that's not cast a round boilie out in a long time, like I certainly haven't fed round boilies for ages. I mean, it's, you know, especially on pressured lakes, it's the most common shape of boilie. I mean, I can think of nothing worse than putting a 15 mil round boilie out, probably the most common thing that's been put in a lake for the last 20 years. So, you know, I always chop my boilies up or use, you know, Nash do like barrel shapes and they do two different sizes of barrels. And that's all I use. To not be a hypocrite, I've been using the cultured hook baits, the key ones. But even they're not round because they come with, there's like a pop-up on the inside, like a wafter on the inside, and then they're coated in like a paste, which are hand-rolled. So they're like odd shapes as well. But that's literally the closest I've come to putting a round bait out in years. So as soon as I saw these bespoke baits, I liked the idea straight away. And the fact that they are like caterpillar slugs and cocoons and grubs, straight away I was interested in him, and we had a good look because his stand at No Nang Show was right next to our Cartcast stand, so yeah, I had a little smell and a sniff every time I went past, and like you said, the guy seems to know his stuff. You know, it's not just another bait company cropped up out of nowhere. You know, this guy's been around fishing a long time. He was telling me about fishing Neville Ficklin's Manton Lake, is it? Is that, you know,
yeah, his old lake.
Yeah, a lot of pictures on the stand that he caught on the baits, and guy seems to know his stuff. So I haven't used them yet. I shall be using them this year. They look ideal for stalking and stuff as well, you know, for in the edge type stuff. They look different, and as we know in carp fishing, anything that's slightly different works usually. You know, whether you fish the peg that nobody's fishing, you know, the unfancied peg on the lake, and you end up just catching the trickiest fish in the lake that only gets caught once a year or once every 2 years. I mean, how often does that come from the peg no one fishes, or the spot no one fishes in the obvious peg? Like, you know, everyone fishes the gravel bar at 80 yards and or the margin, and, you know, or to the island, and then, you know, somebody catches 45 yards out, and but they get one bite and it's the tricky one. I've seen that happen so many times. So we know that doing something different works, and these are very different. So how'd you get hold of him if you want some?
You go to his website, which is www.bespokebaits.com. It's Bespoke Baits on Facebook, Instagram, or go at Bespoke Baits on Twitter to find him there. All the information's there, and send him a message if you want any more info. I'm sure they'll be happy to reply.
Yeah, if you're one of the 10,000 people that came to the No Nang show, you may have seen his stand. To be fair, he was there last year, and I had a look at him last year, and it was just one of them where I kind of, you know, we were really busy rushing about, and you know, I did speak to him, but didn't, you know, I looked at him and thought, oh, that's quirky, it's something different. And once I sat and spoke with him for a bit and had a good look through him, I was like, wow, yeah, this is exactly up my street. You know, this is something that I'm looking for in carp fishing. There isn't much that's new now, and, you know, just doing something slightly different or tweaking something. But at the end of the day, they're boilies, you know, they've got this, they smell like any tub of pop-ups, well, any tub of good pop-ups you're going to get. So, you know, the fish know what they are straight away, but they're just different shapes, and I really like the idea of them. So, yeah, get yourself to www.bespokebaits.com. We'll put a link in the show notes and stuff, won't we, for all these. You can find them. But, yeah, I recommend you trying them out, and especially if you're fishing a tricky lake, you know, a lake... If you're the first person to use, you know, something like this on your lake, you're going to be the one with the little edge on everybody else. So, for sure, check out Bespoke Baits. Have we seen any stuff on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah, which one should we go for first? The testicle-eating fish or the warning for bait companies?
Go for the testicle-eating fish. How can you not?
Oh, yeah. I remember watching this in one of the old River Monsters episodes. It's a Paku, which is originally it's a vegetarian member of the piranha family. Anyway, right. It's grown. It's got very human-like teeth. And, well, according to a newspaper report, its favourite dish is human testicles.
its nickname is the Nutcracker, I'm reading here. Great nickname for a fish. Yeah. It's the Nutcracker because it's a testicle eater. So, yeah, I mean, it originates in the Amazon and Orinoco rivers in South America. And how's it got to Denmark?
Yeah. Who knows? I'm sure it's not through people moving them in rucksacks like we do with carp, or used to, at least.
But they get the name because...
And I'm sure...
They get a name because their jaws can crack nuts and seeds which drop into the water from overhanging trees. So they just think their favourite meal is human testicles. So it's not normally dangerous to people, but as a serious bite. And obviously it thinks your ball sack is some nuts to crack. Which I've got tears in my eyes thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah, do you think Martin at Bespoke Baits, if we take hold in this country, will do some hook bait in the shape of testicles to capture pakus?
Yeah.
Ah, there goes a gap in the market. Yeah, it's from, if you watch the old River Monsters episode, it's where he was in Papua New Guinea. And, you know, people, they just go for a quick skinny dip and they got the balls bitten off.
I'm reading here that one was actually found in the River Seine in Paris.
So they're a bit close for comfort.
Yeah, it is.
I can't obviously can't be proven, but I bet the ornamental fish trade has got a bit of blame.
Yeah, definitely.
Too big for tanks and people dump them, and then it's like you know, it's a few years back, and it probably didn't live long once it was put there. But a snakehead was found in the Witham.
Really?
And they are, nasty. Have you seen any videos on YouTube of those?
No.
They are. Oh, man, there's a few videos up there which, you know, people, they've got a couple of snakeheads in their tank and they drop a goldfish in for fun. And they're savage.
Yeah, I think I might have seen a video of that, actually. Yeah, I think I have, actually. Let's move on. Something else on the net.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Warning for British bait companies. British bait companies could soon be in bother if they don't have the right accreditations. A number of European bait manufacturers and retailers have received fines for selling unregulated bait. The same could happen here if DEFRA, which is the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, follow the lead of their European counterparts and declare fishing bait animal feed. Well, how can you say fishing bait is not animal feed? That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm surprised.
This will happen sooner rather than later, I think, and it's time for bait companies to get their houses in order. I think a lot do already, especially ones that export. If you look on you know, Nashies, for example, all his ingredients in a nutritional breakdown is listed, which is part of these accreditations.
Yeah, that's because they sell a lot of stuff to Europe. All the bait companies that supply to Europe already do this. You know, I've seen, probably begrudgingly, they have to put the recipes basically on the packs. So, but it's only the same as us, you know, buying human food on the pack, just because you're going to buy a really nice, tasty Tesco's finest meal, you know, and it tells you what ingredients are on the side, doesn't mean you're going to make it the same. I've noticed it for the last few years on bait companies' packages, and I'm assuming it's the bigger companies that export to Europe. I guess what the point here is of this article is all these smaller bait companies that have cropped up that are just selling, you know, locally in their area, or they should be doing this, and it's probably something that I would guess. It's just something that's been overlooked in the UK for a long time. And if DEFRA DEFRA commented on this as yet? But if they do,
not that I've seen, but...
Companies that use animal byproducts as part of the ingredients are required to hold an ABP licence, which is audited by DEFRA. Now, animal byproduct, fish meal is an animal byproduct. Which ground fish meal's in pretty much everything.
So, we've got blood meal and liver extracts and...
Exactly.
It's all in there. And, there's a big piece about this in the latest Carp Talk, which we'll, cover in a bit, which, speak to Ian from CC Moore. And he explains it quite well in there, you know.
Yeah, well, it's... Like I say, it's not... It's not going to make any difference to the big companies, but a lot of these smaller bait companies, it's an extra cost, isn't it? They're probably going to have to get licenses, going to have to detail exactly what's in it. I mean, I wanted to speak about bait companies. We've got so much to talk about this week and so little time. A lot of this maybe being Saturday's show, but there are a lot of small bait companies around. There's a lot of very good ones by extremely good anglers that sell to a niche market, and then there's some that people are just repackaging cheap bait, putting their own packaging on it. They have no idea what's in the bait and they punt it. You probably know who I'm talking about. There's quite a high profile guy that's fairly infamous. Not too many people have good words to say about him. I've seen on Facebook people complain about his bait, saying there's glass and all sorts of stuff in it. And his defence was, "Well, I don't know what's in it. I don't make it." great. Yeah, thanks for the vote of confidence. You know, it's just a money maker, and there is a lot of money in bait. We know that. So, you know, bait is a highly tradable commodity in angling, because it's not cheap. And there are people churning bait out. That there's a lot of companies that don't roll their own bait, so they've got no control over the bait. You know, like they might give the base mix to a company and a rolling company, and the company may water it down to make twice as much so they can sell some themselves. I mean, it's not uncommon. That has happened.
Definitely.
There's a big market. I mean, UK angling in the UK is worth £1.5 billion a year. That's how much money is spent on angling, from rod licences to bait to tackle to exporting companies, everything. It's turns over about £1.5 billion. Their official stats, a couple of years out of date maybe, from the Environment Agency that told me that. But, it might have increased slightly. Or might have decreased slightly, but take that as a ballpark figure. That's a lot of money getting turned over in one industry, especially an industry that's generally a cottage industry. Even the biggest names in the game, your Nashies, your Foxes, your Corders, they started out of sheds, people hand making their stuff in our lifetime. For a company that's as big as it is, especially carp fishing now, it's not an industry that's been turning over this amount for ages. So like I say, there's a lot of cowboys out there, there's a lot of very good people as well. Could definitely change things if everybody has to do this. It's gonna, you know, some of the very good small companies might have, it might just be too expensive for them to adhere to all the licenses and accreditations and audits that they have to do. You know, hoping it doesn't put the good ones out of business. But it might regulate a bit more. At the end of the day, I mean, if you try and buy a 26-pound carp, it's going to cost you about £500-600 for a mid-20. Or is it £1,500? I was having a conversation the other day, actually, with a chap I know that's just ordering a load of fish for a lake that's been took over. I've got £1,500 in my head. I think the 30s are £1,500 each. That's right. I mean, you think how many 30s are in some lakes. And if you own those lake and you've no control over what those fish are actually feeding on, like I say, you know, some of these more underground ones that are maybe not quite as honest as some of the better, you know, homemade ones that are taking pride in them. Like I say, you don't want to be feeding, you know, you've got a stock in your lake worth 200k. You know, somebody's feeding them shitty old boilies made out of sawdust off the floor and bits of God knows what in them. I mean, I'd be concerned. I'd want to know that proper bait's gone in my lake. So,
yeah, that leads me on to my point. I think in the long run, you know, if it does come in or when it comes in, it's going to be a good thing. You know, it's also going to be a market employ for a lot of companies. They're going to turn it around. I believe DNA already have. On the bags of, I think it was the switch, they were saying, you know, here's what's in our bait, what's in yours. And
basically calling other companies out.
Point where, oh yeah, but, you know, you're going to be, I can see consumers, you know, those people buying the boilies, we're going to want a boiler, we're going to want to know what's in there. We're going to get, oh, there's no ingredients listed, no nutritional information. We're going to get suspicious, we're going to want to know, or should want to know, what's exactly in our bait. And I think it'd be a good thing. I think a lot of your companies who are, well, peddling poo boilies are not going to be, they're not going to survive. And the good ones, well, the cream always rises.
Fish are expensive, so just putting, you know, it's good to know, I think. And it, like I say, it stops this exact thing happening, these sort of cheap old companies mass producing cheap, shitty boilies and other people buying them, putting a new brand on them and punting them out to people. That's got to be a good thing. So let's do a listener's question, then we'll get Frank in. There's been quite a bit of talk about bait in this one, so it's quite fitting that Frank does a decent chat about bait. I know a lot of our listeners have been requesting bait related stuff. And Frank's just a mine of information when it comes to that. But let's do there's a question that I saw come in. Yeah. Was it into our Facebook page?
Ask us a question.
Yeah, Jack Martin Daniels. Now, take the Martin out, and that is a brilliant name, Jack Daniels. One of my favourites.
Well, it's very possible that his parents had a favourite tipple. That is extremely possible.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, it might be his first name. He might have swapped it around for a bit of cred. I would have done. But anyway, back to the point. He says, I'm a fairly new angler with limited time due to lack of transport. I've struggled to find what works for me in regards to rigs. The guy I cast out, I don't have much confidence as I've lost a lot of fish. And, well, you know, confidence is a major thing. When I started fishing for carp, I didn't really ease myself into straight into the deep end, which has left me fairly confused. Any advice is to find out what works and what path it can take, or is it just a case of trial and error? Well,
you
trial and error is always part of it.
You cut out there on the keywords each time. So Jack Martin Daniels is basically saying he struggles with rigs, he's losing fish, and he didn't really ease himself into rig tying, just jumped straight into the deep end, which I don't know what that means, ease yourself in. I mean, a rig's a rig. There's only one way to do it, and that's in at the deep end and tie it. I don't know if he means he's trying to tie too complicated rigs without kind of learning the basics first. I mean, that would be my advice. But I know you do coaching, don't you, Mark? So, I mean, what do you tell newer anglers?
Well, rigs, I like to, you know, break it down to its simplest form. And your rig, you've got to, when tying up anything, there's four functions it's got to perform. Now, your first one, it's got to get you out there. You know, that's your lead setup. You know, for me right now, lead clips. Simple as that. Number two, it's got to present your bait so it is available and visible for the fish. That is basically whatever you're fishing over. Fishing over a hard, clean bottom, that's easy. If you're fishing over a bit of chod, you know, a little pop-up, a chod rig even. If you're fishing in weeds, you know, a solid bag. You know, three, it's got to hook the fish once it sucks it in. You know, that's your hook end. You know, whether you're using a multi-rig on a pop-up, a little shrink tube kicker, like I am on the drop back I got, which was probably me getting done. you know, that's your hook end. Anyway, number, and your last, it's all got to be strong enough to wind the buggers in. It is as, pretty much as simple as that. And, Aldo, I've got your message. I will, you know, send you a reply, which I meant to do sooner. You know, to, you know, lengthy replies to which rigs actually even give you a few suggestions. But I would keep it simple. Just think about those four principles. Yeah, make sure your bait's available to the fish. And it's hooked. Make sure your puck point is sharp every time. And then it, yeah, we'll hopefully take that doubt out. And it's down to where you put it in creating that feeding situation. And also, you know, I'll take your rigs to a bit of a runs water. You know, catch a few smaller fish on them, get confident. And if you've got another water where you have been blanking or losing fish, once you've got confidence up somewhere else, then take your rigs there. Then, you know, there's a good chance if one of those bigger fish picks it up, you're going to get him. He's going to be having his picture taken.
Yeah, for me, whenever I've messed around with rigs and maybe lost confidence, I always just go back to a basic rig. A rig that is proven that, you know, hundreds and thousands of carp anglers in the country have caught fish on after fish after fish. You know, I know, you know, one of the best anglers in the country, Daryl Peck, when I fished with him when I was younger on St. Ives and stuff, I mean, he was pretty much a size 6 quarter wide gape, some coated braid, which he left coated, and he'd do a knotless knot down to a 20mm bottom bait straight out of the bag. I mean, you could not get more simple than that, and he's one of the most prolific carp catchers in the country. His only real criteria was making sure that hook was the sharpest it could possibly be. Then he used to just sort the sharpest hooks out of a pack. You know, later on we now carry hook sharpeners and stones and stuff, but like, you can't get a better bit of advice than that. I mean, you know, if I was to give you one rig to take the doubt away so that you know it's not the rig, if you do start dropping fish or whatever, you get yourself, you know, 8 inches of a coated braid, strip a little bit off for the hair, you know, strip like 4 inches off or something, tie a loop in the stripped bit, poke it through the back of the hook eye, tie a knotless knot. If you just make it like seven, you know, whip it round the hook 7 times and then go underneath the hair a couple of times so it just kicks it out slightly, then sorry, somebody's trying to ring, that is literally it. That will catch you fish. You know, whip it down 7 times, go underneath a couple of times, kick the hair out slightly, pull it all tight, and that is going to catch your fish. Just make sure you've got a gap of about 0.5 centimeter from the boilie to the back of the hook. What I like to do is when I tie the loop in the strip back bit of braid, I put the boilie on first, put a boilie stop on, so you've just got the actual hook link with the boilie stop, thread it through the back of the eye, whip it around, do a knotless knot 7 times. Just Google it if you don't know how to do a knotless knot, and go back through the eye, pull it tight, have it about anything from 6 to 8 inches in length, and it's not going to tangle, and it's going to catch a fish. You know, when a fish sucks out, I'm not saying it's the most effective rig you can ever use, but it's a solid rig. When it gets sucked in, you're not going to lose the fish. You know, once you get a bite, it's hooked. Not saying you get as many bites as other rigs, but you're probably not going to lose them on that rig. And I think one of the things that people overlook is presentation. So, like, it's very important when you're casting out to hit the clip, I think, you know, to clip up to the distance that you're fishing. Or if you're doing it by sight, you know, you need to stop the lead before it hits the water with your finger on the spool, feather the cast out or whatever, and stop the lead so that the rig falls down nicely behind the lead. And that's very important. You see people that just cast in and then, like, it's just all slack when the lead hits the water and it just kind of lands where it lands. I mean, that I've watched people lose fish after fish doing that, because I just don't think the rig's performing effectively, because it's in a heap on the ground. You know, the lead might have fell on top of the line. It's just all in a mess. And presentation and casting is just as important as the rig itself, because it kind of lays the rig out nicely. And just knowing what you're landing on. You know, you could be landing in the middle of weed if you're not feeling the lead down. So get some practice feeling the lead hitting the bottom, and you can tell if it's landed firm, landed on silt, landed on weed. And it's very possible, depending on, you know, what level of angler you are. But you say you're a beginner, and lots of beginners don't feel the lead to the bottom. It's a skill, and you're not going to be able to do it straight away. And you don't want to whack the clip really hard. You don't want to clip it up to the distance you're fishing, cast out, and like hit the clip, you know, with the lead still in midair, so it springs back, because that's not going to help your presentation either. But a method to kind of guarantee you reasonable presentation whenever is to use a stick, like make a little compressed stick. Only needs to be like 3 inches long. Just buy any stick mix from the shop, or make your own up, or you could use sand, even, like, just damp sand. I mean, the purpose of the stick is to keep your rig nice. So if you cast out with the stick on, pretty much wherever it lands, it's going to be presented okay, and you'll find you'll catch a lot more fish straight away, or you'll land a lot more fish straight away. But I'm guessing it's a combination of how your rig's presented as well. If you're dropping fish, even the basic rig won't perform well if it's not landed right. I watched the Northern Angler.
I'll say, when I seen Rob Hughes do a slideshow in Doncaster a couple of years back, that was one of his big things about you know, hitting the clip and basically feeling it down. Getting that curve so it all lands straight. It's very important, like you say.
It makes such a difference. Even I was watching probably one of the greatest match anglers the UK's ever had was Tommy Pickering at the Northern Angler Show the other week. He did, I don't know if you watched his talk, but he was basically saying exactly what we've just said, but for match fishing with his feeder fishing. He was saying he uses the clip on his rod, he clips it to the distance so he knows it's going out to exactly the same spot every time. Don't forget, these guys are casting regular, aren't they, when they're match fishing. And he was saying it's a big deal, the presentation in how they fish, you know. And he went into great lengths explaining how he hits the clip right with the, you know, the feeder just above the water. And he said, you know, it's right every time, you'll get a bite every time. If it, you know, you hit the clip wrong, it's the difference between getting the bite and not getting the bite. And that's for small fish, you know, match fishing, catching one after the other. So yeah, I think that's very important, is how your lead lands. So I hope that answers your question. Good luck, let us know if you do start catching some fish, and yeah, props on the cool name. We have got some more questions. We were going to do a venue top trumps and stuff, but this is it's going to be over 2 hours this podcast anyway, so I suggest we let Mr. Frank Warwick entertain us.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So I'd like to welcome Mr. Frank Warwick to the Carpcast. Big thanks for doing the Carpcast live at the Northern Angling Show at the weekend, Frank. It was fantastic. We were going to use the recording of that, but it's not come out fantastically great. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us again.
No, you're welcome, Jamie. No problem.
How was the weekend then? Did you enjoy it?
I did, mate. Yeah, I've seen a lot of old friends there, you know. Especially being from Manchester, there was tons of people that I knew. Some of them I hadn't seen for years as well, so it was lovely. It was well attended as well, wasn't it? It was really good show.
Really good, really good turnout, wasn't it? I mean, we kind of knew the Northwestwood supporters. It's built every year, but I think this one was the one where, you know, we were really proud of it. We kind of outgrown those halls and. The trade seemed to love it as well. You know, everybody had a great weekend.
I've seen all the comments on Facebook and everything, you know, all were very positive.
I think it's good for people to get together as well. I mean, there's the obvious look at the new gear and spend your money on bait and, you know, but having chance to chat to people like yourself, you know, Julian Cunliffe spends all the time in the world with people, showing them rigs, and I just think that kind of camaraderie of getting everyone together and having a few drinks in the bar and maybe watching a talk or two, I think the bigger picture, it's a nice thing, you know. I do like them. I do like these shows.
Yeah, I mean, for years we were sort of starved of stuff in the Northwest, weren't we? You know, no one really gave it a second thought. It was always down south, you know. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but we did need that doing up here, and it's nice when you see it's a success, you know.
Yeah, it's such a long way to drive down south, and when petrol went super expensive, it became almost impossible for even the keenies that did drive down south. It was just unrealistic, but...
Yeah.
Back onto you. I mean, what take us back to the start. What got you into fishing? Was it parents? Was it
What it was? My dad was in the Royal Navy, so I never used to see him hardly when I was a kid. He was always at sea because he was in it for 14 years.
Yeah.
So he was like the missing link, you know. He'd do 6 months, 12 months at sea, and he used to try and make up for it for all the time we missed when he got back. And we did all sorts of stuff, you know, bird's egg collecting, which is totally illegal now, but it was legal in them days, and it was our way of just going out in the countryside and spending time together. And then we tried all different sports, used to go to football and everything, and I said to him, oh, I'd love to go fishing one time. I was only a kid, and so we ended up getting some gear and some bits and pieces. We didn't have a clue really what we were doing, and we went to a place called the Old River in Earlham, not far from Eccles. You probably know it.
Yeah.
And it's part of the old Manchester Ship Canal that they blocked off from, you know, God knows how many years ago, maybe 150 years ago or something. And we caught a few roach and stuff, and then he weren't bothered about it, but I realised it was something that I really enjoyed and liked. So I kind of followed my own path and used to get on the bike and get a few rods and go all over the place. And then one day we went out on a little drive in the car, and we ended up at, of all places, Cape Thornall, the stately home in Cheshire. And I remember it was a gorgeous sort of spring day, and we walked across that ornamental bridge that goes across the hall, and it was a classic sort of capability brown landscape, you know, majestic hall in the background, and it looked incredible. I looked over the bridge and I've seen all these what would look massive carp at the time, you know, probably about 18 pound, and perhaps the odd one might have touched 20, and my eyes nearly popped out, you know, because that was about 1970, or no, a bit before that, 1969, and I thought, oh my God, and I wanted to get the gear and fish for him, you know, so we got some carp gear. It wasn't carp gear, it was kind of, because you just couldn't find the shops and the gear in them days, so not very little really, unless you were in that little elite clique at the time that were making their own gear, or you know, you knew where to get it from. I guess Terry Eustace was probably going at that time, and, you know, some other specialist carp rod makers like Jack Simpson and that, but generally speaking, the Going Brothers, Clooper Cart rods, there was those, and, you know, some Tag Barnes rods and things. But I ended up going at Woolworths, and they used to have a little fishing section, and I got some rods that were adequate there. And I went to Cape Sort and seen the old bailiff, Arthur Bradley, who we became great friends, me and him, and he says, oh, why don't you go on and stop ponds? He says, it's easier to catch him on there until you get used to it. And I made friends with an old boy called Bob, who had all split cane rods and the Bruce and Walkers, not the Richard Walker ones, but the Bruce and Walker, I think so at the time, anyhow. And I was looking at his gear, and he had the old Mitchell 300s and all this stuff. I was like, oh my God, it makes my stuff look like shite. But I had an aptitude for it, so I soon started out fishing old Bob, because he was a little bit sort of static with his bait choice. You know, it was either worms, bread, or a luncheon meat. And I started messing around with pastes and making my own concoctions and trying particles as well, like butter beans and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
And but it was great times, you know. It was all, everything was there to discover and explore. So I got totally captivated by it, and that'd be 1970. And I started doing nights. You know, we didn't have bite alarms. I couldn't afford them, so I used to sit awake all night watching the squeezy bottle tops on the line.
And I bet it was bottle tops, wasn't it? For the younger listeners that don't know, back in the day, the fairy liquid bottles and all the washing up liquid, they had a screw off top, didn't they? It was almost pull off.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it had like a cap on it, didn't it? Like an arm. And
they used to close it across the line.
you used to snap it shut across the line, and then it'd rattle, but it wouldn't. You could leave it on, couldn't you? You could reel in and stuff with this thing on.
Yeah, the line used to just go through it where like a ring, so you could play it and it'd be firing about sometimes near your reel, but it didn't seem to matter.
Were you using the old backwinders in the day as well, the churners as we called them?
Oh yeah, I had a few cock-ups with that. I heard about this little fad from down south that you would fish so that the reel would backwind, and I remember going on the main lake at Cape Sort one day, and I'd only just got there and fired a couple of rods out with just pre-lined balls of paste about the size of about a 40 mil boil. It was about that size, just moulded round the size 4 hook, and I just put them in and was looking out over the water, and I was fishing them churner style. And I got an absolute pisser, and it went off that quick that the reel couldn't keep up with the speed the fish was going. So it pulled the old setup in. So I just see me rod disappearing down the lake, and you could see plumes of water coming up where the reel was still spinning while it was in the water. And I'd got them abbreviated cork handles. It was probably the only thing that kept the rod afloat. So it was doing about, I suppose, 15 mile an hour down the lake, and And I, you know, I was panicking because my gear was at a premium in them days, didn't have much money. So I did the obvious thing and did a flying header straight into the lake. And then I was swimming after it, and it got as far as the bridge, so I'd done a good 100 metres. And everyone was pissing themselves, you know, looking at me. And they were all sat on the matchboxes and that, and, you know, the pleasure anglers, and they thought it was hilarious. And the culprit was an 11-pound common. So,
which is a big fish for them.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. And so I landed it by hand in the sort of march with a rod back trailing behind me back to the bank and got out. Well, the happy days they were, you know, they were amazing times. And nothing can ever replace that, you know.
It was
the memories from them.
It's probably rare to see a rod go flying in the water, but, you know, back in, I was only in the 80s when I started, like 82 or something, but we used to fish the backwinders, the churners then, so, you know, you didn't have the reels used to make a funny noise in them days. If you had the anti-reverse on, which is standard now, like, when you reeled in back then, there was like a clicking noise, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was, it was like a sort of like a whirring noise, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the normal position you have your reels in is with the anti-reverse off. So your reel could back wind. So we used to, you know, we'd fish a little drop on the bobbins or monkey clams or whatever. Yeah. And when you got a take, your reel just back wound. But you know what happens when a fish stops, your reel carries on back winding sometimes. So you end up getting line all over the place and tangled.
Yeah, under the spool and everything.
Yeah, and then if it moved off again, your rod went in. Or, as you said, if the take was too quick for the reel to keep up with, the rod went in. Or if you had cheap gear like we did in them days, the rod went in. Like, it was, in fact, it wasn't uncommon for the rod to go in. Like, it was, you know, it was not unexpected. I mean, now with bloody 500-600-700-pound reels and 300-400-pound rods, you'd have a coronary here, you know, 1,200 quid exactly. for gear went shooting off the lake. The clutches are good these days, and it doesn't make that horrible noise when you have the anti-reverse off, but... it's some people probably have never seen a rod go in, but
exactly.
It's something about it as well, though, isn't it? It was part of a good day's fishing. If you've seen, you know, just managed to grab the handle on the way into the lake.
I've seen some hilarious things, you know, looking back over the years. I mean, I often talk to other anglers and say, have you ever seen out funny on the bank? And that, some of them say, no, nothing much really. And that, I've seen tons of things happen that was just hilarious. You know, you couldn't write the script for it.
So, I had a rod go in recently, actually, a few years ago on Chorter Marina. I was down there with Roger, just gone for a couple of days, and found this spot off the island, like a little hole off like the main island down the bottom. And I think I'd been the week before, actually, and I'd like three takes in 24 hours off this hole. So I've got straight back in the peg, and Roger's sat with me, summer's day. I banged one rod out, clipped it up, got it perfect in the hole, put the rod on the rest, put the bobbin on, left it in the clip, sat down to do the next rod. Roger's sat like 2 foot from the rod, and I'm probably 4 foot from it in the bivvy door. Yeah. And I've got a screamer, it's bobbins at the top, and the rod, basically both, it was so powerful that both bank sticks just flattened to the floor. Like, the rod was locked up in the bank sticks. The buzzer hit the deck, and the backrest hit the deck at the same time. It just like collapsed it, and the rod just torpedoed into the water. I was like, Ben and I, both of us were sat right by it, and nobody even had, this all happened in the space of a second and a half. It just went,
it's incredible, isn't it, the speed they go in,
I had to strip off bollock naked and go in for it, and I lost the fish. We had to like cast the marker like sideways over the top of where the rod should be, pick the line up. It was all snagged, so I had to swim out to the rod, managed to get the rod, get it back to the bank, and then the fish was still snagged on the island, so I ended up swimming out to try and free it. And then
it's a reasonable swim, that one, as well, isn't it, if it's a side island, thinking of the longer chuck to it.
Yeah, I don't know what it was from memory. It may be 70 yards or something, I don't know. But I've gone out there, and I can see the fish. I'm touching with my feet, you know, trying to free it from the branches. Yeah. It wasn't massive, but once I scared it, it got off.
Jamie, just a sec. I just have to shout my lad. He's just come in. He didn't know that we were doing this. And he's, you know, that he wants to be a DJ, and he's got music belting out upstairs. Could you just give us a second while I give him a shout?
No worries.
So
you went from Cape Thorn. I mean, do you remember that first time you caught one of them big fish that you saw swimming about? You know, that first thing that was bigger than a roach.
I went to Cape Thorn all on the. We used to. There was a great big chestnut tree. Them horse chestnuts, not conkers, they're like chestnuts. And some of them trees was 100 years old. And they made a big line all the way down to the hole originally. A lot of them died over the years, and there was a great big one at the side of the stock pond, and it was in the outer bounds. And we used to spy out for half the old bailiff driving past and wait, make sure he was out of sight, and then get a quick stalking rod and get under the barbed wire fence and get in there. And all the fish thought they were safe there. They'd all be the back spread out, vortices and everything. So you used to get a float that set at about 12 inches deep, and just ball of paste and all sausage meat, and lower it in, and the float would be spinning round with all the vortices, and then it'd just slide away, and all hell would break loose when you crack one, you know. And it was a little adventure, sort of breaking the rules, really, and getting in there, and you know, sort of taking the piss, really, catching where they thought they were safe in the little sanctuary. But it was great, you know, you could always guarantee a bite. So if it was, if you were scratching, you could get in there and have a go. But part of the fun I had was, I noticed, because we were using really crap rigs in them days, you know, burying the hook inside, pace, or luncheon meat and stuff like that, you weren't getting good hookholds. We weren't using, if we used a lead at all, it'd be something like a 1 ounce lead. So, much indication, it was like all these twitches. You'd see your bobbins were bouncing up and down and never stay still, really. Yeah. So it showed how much the fish were taking on the rig and just, you know, having it in the mouth and blowing it out and sucking a piece of paste off and frustrating. And of course, we were naive. Everyone was, really, before the exposed hook rigs, like bolt rigs and hair rigs. We used to think that they could see the hook, you know, and that you had to bury it. And but it was interesting because the more interesting your mix was, the more twitches you got all the time, which meant that the fish were attracted more to the bait, so they're constantly having it, you know, and really taking the mickey out of it, because they knew that it was, you know, they could get away with murder. So I started thinking, I need to find a better way of getting good indications. So I made my own swing tips from knitting needles, some of my mum's knitting needles, whipped a few eyes on them and a fit ring with a slicking rubber, and I had that hanging on the end of the rods, hanging down, and started hitting the slightest fish on the swing tips, and I started having loads of fish like that, you know, and much more than the guys that were waiting for the bobbin to slam up and, you know, get a churner or a fairly hefty bite. And so I was getting the slightest indication, striking as soon as he got it inside the mouth or in the lips, and that was what was working.
That must have been a big edge at the time, because, like you say, you kind of had to strike while the fish was moving, because, like, your hook was buried, wasn't it? Like, it was either inside luncheon meat or inside a ball of paste. So the amount of times you got screamers
through the bait.
The amount of times you got screamers and picked the rod up and there's nothing there, like, you know,
I'd
see it four or five times in a day sometimes. You wouldn't land one of them. It's just like, wind, and it's away. And so to have that first bit of indication before it's even happened to be able to strike must have been a huge edge at the time.
It was, yeah. And I started messing around, I must admit, with sort of stiffening pace up and started to boil the baits, which kind of made it work. You think, you know, I'll skin the bait up and that for casting, and that was, you know, with the hook inside, you can imagine that. I thought, no, this ain't working. And I was kind of thinking my way around it and started messing around with bits and pieces, not too far off the hair rig, to be fair, but not quite there. And you know, but when obviously then I was started reading bits and pieces, and I noticed Kevin Clifford was talking about sweet corn. He was fishing for other species as well as carp, and I thought, do you know what, I'm going to try that. And my God, that was a completely different ball game. As soon as he used the sweet corn, wow, it was, you know, because it's so soft, and you know, they were hooking themselves because they were crushing the corn, and you're getting proper bites and that, and that was phenomenal. And I mean, I went through all the particles. You know, and I caught some really weird things when I was messing around. I mean, butter beans was a bit of a strange one, but the carp really loved those. Using sultanas. Yeah. Butter beans were an immense bait. The fish just go, they love them because they're so visual as well, you know.
Yeah.
I caught kidney beans, maples, tares, obviously hemp, and didn't know about tiger nuts in them days. But sultanas worked as well, which is just dried out grapes, really. And we used to use a lot of cat biscuits as well, you know, like munchies and gold cat and all that, you know. And obviously kitty cat, the cod flavour in particular was good, and salmon. We used to get the big tins, like the big size ones that you get for cats, and it used to stink like crap. And you get that out full of bones and... breadcrumbs and packs of breadcrumbs and stuffing mix with sage and onion in, and you know, all manner of things. I never stopped grinding stuff up in a grinder and putting things in. But the big sea of change was when I started using chili and curry powders in the baits.
Yeah.
That made a fairly hefty difference, and I was using PYM, Phillips yeast mix, which is anything to do with yeast, the carb love. They adore it. Any yeast-based products.
It's weird. What do you think that is? I think this is just the makeup of it, or
Well, I mean, there's a yeast-based enzyme that I was using when I was doing the boilies, and it's carp have got a fairly basic digestive system, as you know. It's just a digestive tract, and the only enzyme they've got for breaking things down is trypsin, which is a fairly strong enzyme, but it's not a multi-layered enzyme like humans. We've got several that break down all our foods because we're omnivores and we can eat all manner of things, you know. But carp are fairly, they've evolved just to basically bloodworms, mollusks, shells, snails, that kind of thing. So they didn't need a very complex gut system to extract a bit of protein to get into the blood via the liver. So basically, you know, when we started giving them all these unusual things, can't digest a lot of it. So it's straight through. You know, you get some anglers say, oh, that bait's brilliant, isn't it? Look at that, they've shipped it all out. Well, that means that they've not had much of it. It's just gone straight through and waste product. So your bait's actually not as good as you thought. It's just been crapped out quicker because they've not been able to take much out of it. And so there's a product called Brokacell, which is a yeast-based enzyme, and they give it pigs and cattle, and they give it salmon in these in the pellets from the fish aquaculture. And what it does is it breaks down a lot of the proteins for the fish and the, you know, fats, lipids. It breaks them all down. It's very active, so you can get a bait that's typically, I would say 16 to 20% digestible. You put 3% by volume of the Brokacell in, and you've suddenly got a bait that the fish can utilize because you're adding to their range of enzymes that start breaking it down quickly, so they can get more than 50% out of it. You know, so it's an incredible thing. But it's attractive in its own right because it smells of yeast. And
what made you start thinking that way? It seems like you were onto bait edges from an early point in your fishing career. I mean, you know, I've got into you know, trying to think think about the habits and stuff, but I've never really gone down the, oh, what if we tweak this, what if we tweak that. I mean, I used to make my own baits as a kid, but buying 50-50 mixes and adding a couple of things to it and trying different flavourings. I mean, when you're going into actual things that make fish's digestive tracts act differently, and, you know, I remember hearing about MSG for the first time years ago, and, you know, the fact that that just made him want to eat more, and it made sense. But it sounds like you're onto that really early on in your carp fishing career.
I was, Damien, because, you know, it was so frustrating when we didn't have the proper rigs, and there was no one to learn off, really. There was, you know, very few people doing carp fishing, so it was all a big exploration job. And what I found was, as I said before to you, when I started messing with some of the concoctions, if you put something like curry powder in, Madras curry powder, they'd want to pick it up so much more. So you get the amount of rod shakers and sheer activity told you that, oh, we're onto something here. It was like instant. It's not like now where you're doing a lot of guessing with boilies, because what we're doing at the moment is rod minding, where you're not actively doing so much. Most people are buying proprietary boilies from a certain company, and they wear the shirt with pride and they're part of a team or this or that. But you kind of, the essence of the carp fishing has been sucked out of it to a degree for me, because I'm from that era where you had to make it happen yourself by being creative with ingredients. And like I say, when you had something tangible that was good, the fish would take it on all the time more. So you got to see instantly. It's like putting it under a microscope and seeing an instant result, because you knew if it was crap, the indicators didn't move. So you think, right, let's get that out of there. And then you put something else in them that's good. You know, I remember using, I know it's basic now, but just trout pellet, ground trout pellet in the bait. And bear in mind that no one was using trout pellets per se for the carp fishing version in them days. Perhaps a few people in Ken, like Jerry Savage and that. But when I started using ground up trout pellet, boom, the indicators were bam, 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 you know, and I thought, oh, they like that. So you're learning stuff all the time, and you know, I realised very quickly that they liked onion.
Really?
I mean, onion oils, you know, these old Mexican onion oil, which I don't advise anybody to use because it's just the most hideous smell ever. But onion's a very interesting thing, you know, and it's like garlic, same family.
Hmm.
You know, when I was messing with garlic in the bait in the early days, that definitely had a little thing about it, which we know now, you know, we accept that, provided you use it carefully. But in the old days, didn't. So I was messing around with all manner of things. And because you got a quick result, it made it, you built up a repertoire in your mind of all the best things to get the indicators moving. So I started blending all them. And then when boilies came along, I just, you know, you mixed them with eggs and a few other bits and pieces, and then we were away. But then boilers were very effective, you know. And to me, because we're fishing with self-hooking rigs and stuff now, it's more a matter of which brand of bait's the best, right? What's in the bait? Because none of us are really privy to know exactly what these bait companies are putting in. We just sort of kind of rely on the local expert who's doing this for the company, you know, it, like Gary Bays or, you know, John Baker and people like that. And you know, a lot of people put the faith in that, Kev Knight, you know, and of course they make great baits and all the rest of it. I think it takes that little bit of magic out of it, whereby you're actually in control of your own destiny and you can go, right, I know there's a lot of guys tried making their own baits and it sort of fell flat on its face and it's been a dismal failure. But at least you're learning. If you do it yourself and it don't work, you think, well, okay, it's back to the drawing board. Let's do another one and another one and another one. And that's how it used to be, you know. It was a persistent thing whereby if you, like anything, if you stick at it, it eventually comes good. But you can't hope to do, if you're lucky, you might get it right, but it's a learning process, you know. And I think it's such a shame that a lot of the younger anglers or newcomers to the sport just don't even make their own hook baits, you know. Even cork ball pop-ups, they'll go to a company and get them rolled, and, you know, and it's such a shame, because I think that's part of the mystique of carp fishing, is making your own baits that you've had in your hands yourself, you know, and you've got, it's the essence of it, you know.
There's no better satisfaction than rolling your own boilies at home. I mean, even, you know, I got in the late 80s, I got into the, you know, buying all the individual ingredients and, you know, copying recipes out of books and stuff. But I mean, even just when, you know, I used to buy I'd buy a kilo of ground fish meal, I'd buy a 50-50 mix, I'd buy a couple of sweeteners, a few different flavours, and put it together, basically. I'm just, you know, it's like making a leek and potato pie recipe out of a cooking book, you know. But still, that satisfaction, you take it down to the lake and you get a bite on your first session on it, you're like, the bait works, you know. You've got the satisfaction of catching a fish like we do now, but you've got the second satisfaction of having kind of created something, made it more personal. And I'm as guilty as the next man, you know. I mean, how many people actually roll boilies now? There's so many good quality bait companies out there. I mean, those days of putting out sausages and pre-sausage guns, when you used to have the sausage roll, Gardner sausage roller, and then you have the 10 bait bloody boilie roller you'd do. You make the sausage first and you make the round. It'd take you a whole night to make a kilo of boilies.
Well, check this out. When I was a young fella and I first discovered women, I had various girlfriends and that, and they all knew I was a fanatical carp angler. And I actually used to roll them in the hand, and I got good at doing four at a time, you know, where you were a show-off and you could do two, then you could do three, and then you could do four, and they were fairly passable as dead round. Yeah. Well, I had various birds sat in the bedroom with me. I used to get them up there and say, right, I've got like 4 pounds of boilies I need rolling in, and I'd have them sat there, you know, and then afterwards I'd give them one.
Smelling of Hutch's monster crab or something.
it was happy days then, you know. They all used to sort of put up with it and that, you know, because it was quite persuasive. And,
I mean, now, like you said, not many people make hook baits, but I mean, even if you're going to use a base mix or use a shop bought boilie, which, you know, there's tons of very good ones out there now, having your hook bait a little bit different, it still gives you that personal feel. But you were somebody that obviously once the boilie came around, I mean, you did kind of keep experimenting with your hook baits You were known for the single hook bait fishing, which obviously they have to be right. If you're putting no bait around it and not creating a feeding situation, then those hook baits have got to be attractive, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And I remember there was a bloke on Leeds, mate, Alan Kirk, and he was watching me catch a load of them fish just blasting singles out in the lake, and I remember him saying, oh, I've not even bothered to do that. I'm just using he found them abacuses with all the coloured wooden balls on it. He said, look at this FW. He said, they're not only brilliant colours, but they're made of wood, so they're natural pop-ups, so I don't have to mess about. And he just never got a bite on them.
He never caught on a
wooden
bit of wood.
Ball that they were bright colours, though, you know, and you think, well, it's an artificial bait. And he was soaking them in flavour and stuff, but it just never worked. As far as I know, it just didn't work. No.
And yet you took kind of plastic to the next level.
Well, yeah, but that was sweet corn. Stuff where you're fishing over mass baits, so you've got a bag with it. And, you know, it tended to work almost as a decoy whilst it was amongst a little bit of food. I mean, I've caught some English 40s and stuff, strangely enough, on just plastic, but... and in the dark, just two pieces blasted out on that Wellington Country Park, for example. You know, but it there's a lot of fish in there, and they don't seem to hold back for feeding. They're definitely eating machines and things. And but you know, I think there is a fine art to even getting singles where they'll tack them on more. You know, because it's. You know, it's a separate leap of faith, really, because a lot of people just, to this day, they haven't got the bottle to just fish a single hook bait. I still meet people who say, oh, no, I can't do that. I have to have a bag on.
Me too. Like it takes me yeah. getting around. I spoke to a few people that are, you know, really good single hook bait anglers, and obviously yourself being one of those. And I don't know, it batters me head, but I know it works. And I spoke to people at the opposite. They can't get their head around people putting, you know, 50 spuds of bait on the spot, and they're like, well, how on earth did you find your hook bait? Like, I'd rather just have the hook bait there and nothing else.
Well, what I do, Jamie, I mean, I tended to get pigeonholed and labelled and just use singles all the time, and it's really not quite the truth at all. It was just a successful string to my bow, you know. I just have a time and a place for doing that. And I'll start with some waters up, typically. And I used to just do a little bit of a tour. And I especially like waters where there was a sanctuary, where you'd have to be a better caster to get singles to, where the fish were just completely untouched, basically. So, I mean, like I said the other day, I was doing that talk. Most of them situations, the fish will go out of range in the daytime when they're getting cast at or, hammered. They eventually just back off. So the moves of the sanctuary area, these impenetrable snags will sit in there most of the time. but they have to come out because they've scoured every single bit of food in there. The bottom's polished, they've had everything, and it's almost like, tell you what, boys, we're going to, let's go again, let's get over in the trenches and go and stick our neck out and find some food. Everton, that'll be that band of water between sort of 40 yards out and 120 yards where people are spotting a lot and or using a stick. And then they'll come in at night when everybody's in the land and nod.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, they'll make them, they'll leave the sanctuary. That's why singles don't work in sanctuary areas at night so well, I think.
Because you know, don't think I think they're in
they,
there.
No, they've just vacated that and come to the margins where when it's quiet to feed and they feel safer under the cover of darkness a lot of the time. And, I mean, you know, Reedsmere was a classic. The first bite would be 6 o'clock in the morning in summer. Very rarely before. Yeah. I mean, you just left your singles out at night, wasting the night ready to get... So you weren't disturbing it in the morning when they backed off and they were fizzing out in the middle. So you'd have it ready in situ. They'd come across it and then bam. But you think about it, they'd backed off, gone back to the sanctuary area in the daytime. And then there's a bit of food nagging them away. They're seeing it thinking, this is my house, this is safe here, that's got to be safe, because they just hadn't seen baits there before. So, you know, they were checking it on straight away. It was like, woof, oh, happy days, look at that, bam. It was instant, it was incredible. And then when everybody's doing it, it loses its effect to a degree. So you have to stay one step ahead, you know, and then you can, or try to. And then I was messing with all kinds of, I wanted to learn as much as I could, as quick as I could, before everyone caught up with me, really, because I'd got that sort of first user advantage. So I was messing, not putting any flavours in, just putting massive amounts of sweetener in to see if that would attract them. And it repelled them. You know, I started off very heavy with loads of sweetener in the mix, and they just wouldn't touch it. And then I started messing with bright baits with no flavouring, no sweeteners, no nothing. That was slow as hell. It was really slow, so it wasn't... That told me it wasn't just a visual thing, that they were getting a chemical cue from the smell. And then when my mate, he's a diver, he went out in Reedsmere, before they started bone mealing it, and he said he had to... He's a diver, he went out on the mare to have a look and report back what he was seeing on the QT. He did it in the close season. He said the silt was up to his waist. He said they had to release his buoyancy aid to get him out, because he got disorientated. All the water went jet black with all the silt coughing up and that, you know. And he said, Jesus, he said, the silt in the detritus that's in suspension, he said it was just like soup. So I thought, not everywhere.
These like areas you thought you were fishing... You know, thought you were fishing on harder bottoms and stuff, and there's just more silt there that you didn't even know was there.
No, I knew it was shoddy, because we used to get the leads back jet black where they'd been stained with this stuff, and your baits had come back, even though they were bright, they were, you know, yellow baits, and they were black underneath and stunk of shite. The silt on the bottom like bad eggs, and but we still got bites in there. But obviously, if you could find a cleaner, fresher area where you weren't getting that staining and taint, you'd get much more action. But then I started messing, using very long hook lengths, but using the pop-ups between 8 and 9 inches off the bottom.
Yeah.
And when I fished them 1 inch or half an inch, like the tipping would now, you're virtually pissing in the wind. You couldn't get bites. They were very few and far between. But when I used them 8 and 9 inches off, plenty of bites. I mean, I used to con some of the other boys, unfortunately. I had to try and protect my own interests. But I'd make a big show of having a shot an inch under the pop-up.
Yeah.
And you used to have to wade out in the lake to cast. So just before a cast, I'd sort of shield it with my body and just quickly slide the weight up 9 inches and then crack it out. And then when I landed a fish, I'd jump on it quick and slide the shot back down. A few of my close mates, you know, they knew what we were doing, and Cookie and some of the other old boys, they knew, but we tried to keep it as quiet as we could for a long time. And funny enough, it's something that you don't see many people doing anymore out like that. You know, it's either zigs or on the bottom. or close
was
to it.
Was it just to get it above the bottom layer of silt? Was that the purpose of just fishing 8-9 inches?
Well, that was the idea, but what happened was, I called it gob level. When you think about it, with a single bait, unless you've got something that's kicking off quite a lot of smell and attraction, you've just got a single hook bait that will soon become washed out. So in effect, what you've got is the fish, as you know, they're mostly up in the upper layers. They very rarely travel with a belly skimming the bottom, especially in 8, 10, 12 feet. So they're up in the water. So if that water's got a modicum of colour and silt on the bottom, it's almost like a needle in a haystack situation. So my idea was to just fish it so it was above a lot of that cloudy crap, in case it was sitting in and going and doing something I didn't expect. So it's just by a process of elimination, fishing at different levels. Plus, I did another thing as well. This revealed something to me. I forgot to tell you that. In the old bolt rig days, I remember I got in Selcon-Trent and just after Pierre had lost it in the old days, and I was messing around with buoyant baits. I microwaved some of me free offerings, and they became really buoyant pop-ups. It almost, you know, when they become a bakey, we used to call them. And I also baked some in the oven, and I put yeast in there, because I used to work in a bakery. I got some baking yeast, and that obviously made them swell up a bit, and they were super buoyant. I remember side hooking one with a size 4 hook, and I took it down the mirror, and I thought, I'll try one on the bottom, I'll try this, and I fished it straight off the lead, which would have been a zig rig, really, like a boiler rig. This was 1980, and I whacked that out, and that never went in the dark, but I put some bait out with a wrist rocket sort of thing, and I remember that rattling off at first light, and that was about 2.5 feet off the bottom, straight off the lead, and I thought, oh, wow, that's worked. So I had no qualms about setting my sort of floral or very bright baits 8, 9, 10 inches off the bottom, and but I never seemed to go further than that and try them higher, you know, because I was getting that many bites using them at that level, and I just called it gob level, because I thought even if they're sort of swimming really close to the bottom, if you've got a good 20, you know, that's going to be right in front of its face, and it'll still see it from above, and it just worked. It really worked, you know.
So you went on from, you experimented with bright baits, you experimented with messing about with the flavour levels, the sweetener levels, and you kind of, what then? You arrived at like the perfect balance of single hook bait? I mean, what is the perfect single hook bait?
Well, what I realised, Jamie, was there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. I've always been someone that likes to delve into things deeply. If I get interested in something, I want to do it properly.
Yeah.
And it's always my intention to do my very best to see how far I can push, roll it out a bit, you know. So I used to go to the Manchester Central Library, and I was getting the Ultimate Synthetic Flavour Guide. I think it's something like Benelotti's, it was called. It was like a massive, big volume. And it told me how all the different flavours were made, all the different esters and, compounds that go into these flavours. And then there was the essential oils version with all different essentials, where they come from, either the root, the fruit, the bark, or the leaves of trees, and how they're made and how strong they are and what uses they've got, like in beverages or in medicines and this, that and the other. So I used to study these things and come up with all these mad concoctions, and I was trying them in the singles, and they became a few common denominators that stuck out to me, and isoeugenol was one of the things that was a recurring theme. And isoeugenol is a range of a family of things that actually are known to be attracted to carp, but there's certain things like clove that's got a numbing effect on carp. I don't know if you know about that.
No.
Well, clove, you know when you get toothache, you rub clove oil into your teeth and your gums.
Right.
You know Bonjela? Bonjela, yeah. For babies that are teething. Well, that's got it in, and it's got a natural pain suppressant in it.
Right.
And what it does is it makes your lips and your mouth and everything, it's an anaesthetic.
Yeah.
And basically, it anaesthetizes the carp's flesh and the nerves. So it did occur to me that some of these experiments I was doing, I started getting really deep hookholds. It occurred to me that maybe I was sort of anaesthetizing them so they that they couldn't know. Feel the hook and the line as it entered the mouth. Because these things are very potent, and they've got carp have got 120,000 taste buds, and we've got 10,000. So they're 12 times more than us.
Wow.
So, you know, they're very sensitive, the mouths, and tactile. They can do stuff with the mouth, like trap one grain of hemp in the top of the mouth with the palate, separate all the mud, blow it out the gills, and keep one grain of hemp.
Yeah.
That's how clever they are at manipulating things. So it stands to reason, as soon as they feel the hook and the line over the lip, it's going to be like you having a human hair in your food.
Mm.
Except times 12, because they're much more sensitive. So it's going to be a quick bang in and out. I suspect that we'd be terrified if we knew how many times fish are taking us on, cleaning us out, stripping every bait. They've had our hook baits in the mouth several times and got shut of it, and we're none the wiser.
Yes.
Oh, we've had a few rod shakes and bangs. So I had all that in mind, so I was working towards getting as many pickups as possible, because I knew they were dealing with the rigs. Even when we were fresh on the hair, they were still getting short of it. It's what they do. So I wanted a bait that was so attractive and so irresistible that they would be coming and taking it on all the time, and they couldn't stop themselves, they had to. And that was the reason why the old 5 mil of flavour in a single hook bait just didn't cut it. So I was doing stuff like 70 mil of squid octopus in more recent years to a two-egg mix.
And that's getting crazy, isn't it, when you think about it? I mean, they're never swallowing that bait, are they? So, I mean, it's...
No,
is it because
well,
of what it's giving off in the water?
Yeah, because like I said to you, you've got one little tiny vessel. It's like, it's your one little chance is all wrapped up in a 16 mil ball or whatever size you want to use. So basically, you've not got the luxury of being delicate about it. You've got to sometimes think, well, do you know what? You could have used a washed out unflavoured thing, and if you're there for 3 or 4 days or a week, they might think it's a washed out bait that's been discarded and take it. But normally you want it now. You want it there. Come and get me. I'm here. You know, swoop in. Have a go. And it's like you. If you in the morning you get up and you smell someone cooking bacon and egg, and the wind's coming in your direction, you might have not even been thinking about bacon and egg. You might have been thinking about I want to go for a crap or something like that. But you smell the bacon and egg coming across, and you go, Jesus Christ, I could murder bacon and egg. So
it
programmed
your taste buds, yeah.
Yeah, of course it does. So, I mean, it's like walking past a curry house when you've been out on the beer and that. You're like, Jesus Christ, I want one of them. But if the wind was blowing in the other direction and you never smelt it, it might not cross your mind. So therefore, when you've got that, what you've got in there, you've got that signal coming off. I've had letters today and messages on Facebook off guys. One bloke said, I've got some old boilies that are about 5 years old from all different companies. Shall I throw them away? You know, pop-up singles. Mm. Or shall I redose them? I says, redose them. So I'll give him some levels to put in and some combinations. And he says, but surely I'll need sweeteners in these, won't I? Because it'll repel the fish. I says, not really. You can get away without them because they're not eating it as such. They're just coming over and sucking it in.
Yeah.
There isn't a slight element of taste before it, but it'd have to be... You think of how much flavour you'd have to have billowing out to actually repel them on a single update. You can't really overcook it. Of course you can with food. You can kill it stone dead. But not with singles. You can go super extreme.
I mean, that is extreme.
I don't know anyone that's put 70, 80 mil of a flavouring in a, like I say, in a direct mix.
Jamie, I've had them sat in neat flavour for a year.
Yeah.
So it's just dripping with it. Yeah. And we used to test it on Cuttle Mill in the winter. And I've had the indicators just rattling. I had a 30 and I think 620s in the morning before 11 o'clock, and they were on really high flavoured, super flavoured squid octopus and monster crab baits that blew your head off. They blew your head off. But the food was putting in, they were 10 millis that had dried out like little wooden balls, and they shrunk down to like 8 mil. They sounded like little, you know, like little acorns. But I was feeding heavy with them and spraying them, and they had virtually no flavour in. So I wanted to focus attention on the hook baits over the top. You know? But it worked.
Going back to the plastic, I mean, I when plastic first came out and you could first kind of buy the original Enterprise comb, which I know you were working with them, I remember being on Wire Lake about 13, 14 years ago, and it only just come in the shops, and then the lad that I met on there was to become a good friend, Dave, afterwards. I remember him blasting a fish had shown by the island, and he had two bits of fake plastic corn on. It was unflavoured in those days. There was no flavourings in the early ones. It was straight up yellow plastic out the packet. It smelt of plastic when you smelt it. He blasted it to the island, and he got a take 10 minutes later. No bait, no nothing. I could not get my head around what happened. I watched it. I was like, are you mad casting it out? And then it went. So, like, the plastic does have a smell. Do you think carp are attracted to that smell? The plasticky smell?
Of course they are, Jamie. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you a story, right? I used to get my fish meals from Isaac Spencer's, a big fish plant in Fleetwood in Lancashire. So I used to go over there, and I used to chat to the owners and everything. They became friends of mine. And they said, I said, what do you do with these fish meals and some of the oils out of them and some of the other byproducts? So they said, oh, have you seen some of the other things we do? And they showed us this fish emulsion. And it was like bill cream. Big tubs of bill cream. It was just the same consistency. And I says, what do you do with that? And it was white, like toothpaste almost. And it smelled dead fishy, but not as fishy as any of the other products. It had been refined down. And I says, what do you do with that? And he said, oh, it goes in all the plastics. And it's a rubber replacement, and they use it in trainers. So, you know, when you get some new trainers and you think it's the glue that's bound them together that smells fishy. It's not. It's the fish emulsion that they use in the plastics. So I don't know if you ever seen it, but if koi pews and mice and rats, they'll eat the Duplon on your rods and they'll eat your reel handles.
That's right. Yeah.
You get them gnawed. Well, that's because they can smell the fish emulsion in there and it's giving off a food signal.
Wow.
So it follows on that when you've got. Plastic baits like that, there is an element of that in there that sort of smells fishy.
So
you wouldn't even smell it easy.
Yeah, there's something in there that could have come from some sort of, organically, like, you know, some sort of attractor type ingredient, you know, somewhere along the way.
Yeah, of course.
That's in plastic.
Well, it's like it's giving off something that sort of fools them enough to get the bite. Because, you know...
Even if it's been replicated, it's a food signal.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've ever studied other animals. I mean, I study birds and other species to see what their behaviour is and think, well, I wonder if a carp are like that and fish. Because if you go on to, say, Reedsmere by the roadside and you've got all them ducks, mallards and God knows what else other species there, and you can chuck in most edible things and they'll get it in the beak and they'll swallow it fairly quick. But you put a piece of inedible stuff in or a piece of chewing gum or something that's not good for them, they get it in the beak and drop it instantly.
Yeah.
So they've not got it back at the back of the beak and sort of got any taste buds going. It's they know that that's not edible in a split second.
Yeah.
And... you know, you can learn a lot from other species. I mean, I know it's going off at a tangent, but I like doing this. What I was going to say, I learned something. That it kind of was one of them moments where you go, wow, I've suddenly realised what's going on here.
Yeah.
I was fishing one lake, right, and it was winter time, and a load of pheasants came out. and they were wanting to feed right at my feet. So I got a load of mixed particle that I'd got, and I'd been catching loads of fish on maize and sweet corn amongst the particles using balanced maize. This is before the plastic, but other people had cottoned onto it because it was working so well, and they were starting to use it. So I thought, you know what, I'll dye the corn red and orange, some of it. So I thought, well, I'm using it on my rigs, different colours, and there was a sudden decrease in action. I thought, I wonder what that's all about. Anyway, I started feeding these pheasants, and there was two things that came from that, feeding these pheasants. One was they start from the edge of all the food. Right. So they start right at the edge. They don't go to the centre. So, you know, and they work the way through it. They always start at the edge. If you put a load of bread in your garden, the birds don't land in the middle. They land on the outer edge of it and eat the stuff on the edge first.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So carp are doing that as well. So, you know, when you get these people, they'll get a marker out and they're trying the best to get it right in the middle of the spotted area and that. But I don't do that anymore. I try and do a strategy to fish. I'll use two markers and I'll do my level best to get it right on the edge.
Yeah.
So they encounter my hook baits fairly early on, trying to speed things up. And what I'm getting at is, imagine, say you're on a lake and you know, like on Horseshoe, the fish used to, if you were on the Whitney Bank, the fish would start off in that summer bay, they'd go down the trout bank and they'd work their way out and come round to you. You could see people getting runs, it was tangible as they came.
Yeah,
you've seen it, haven't you? And then you see all the different people getting runs as a big massive shoal comes towards you.
Yeah,
and you get wiped out. You might get three or four runs and then they'd move on to the person to your left.
Yeah.
And I sussed this all out at the time. So we did them into regional matches, and I thought, right, I'm going to get two markers. I'm going to position my three rods, one further out, one sort of medium, and one closer, all on the right-hand side of my bait. Well, I managed to, the two lads as we got three each, but I got six. I know it sounds round numbers, but that was exactly what it was. Because I got a second bite of the cherry. I managed to get the rods back out and get more bites before they'd moved to the centre of my bait and clean me out, because they did eat a lot of bait, them fish. And then you could work out, like, on some waters the fish will be out in the middle in the daytime, and then, you know, at night they're going to come from the middle, like I was saying, to the margin. So you could have all three rods on the back of your baited area. Do you know what I mean? So it's tactical bait positioning.
Yeah.
And that occurred to me, that if you can work out which way the fish are going to come to your swim, you can have your rods primed and ready to almost like three landmines sat there waiting for them, so they stand on them early on. Do you know what I mean? And the other thing I learned from the birds was that they wouldn't pick up the dyes that I'd used. Must have been repellents, because they'd pick it up and drop it instantly and wouldn't eat it. So stop using it. Yeah.
What was the thinking behind the glow in the dark comb? Where did that come about?
Well, what happened was, I was getting a little bit, curious about what fish can see and discern and all the rest of it, and thinking back about how murky it can be beyond sort of 8 feet. You're getting the lights fading and it's not so bright down there, and I know how curious fish are, and I've done a lot of sea fishing in the past, and I noticed that when I use the glow in the dark beads when I was fishing for flatfish, in particular in deep water, like 100 foot deep, you get loads more bites if you had the glow in the dark beads on, even in daylight, because there's not much light going on down at them depths. So it's almost like it catches their eye, and then you'd have a lugworm or a ragworm on a little flounder spoon, and then they'd be attracted by the movement and the light flashing. It's like an anglerfish. It has that little light on its head that it waves about, and then the small fish are attracted to it, and then it just grabs them and eats them. So I thought, well, if I can get... I remember I said to Chris at Enterprise, I said, listen, Chris, it's a bit wacky this, but I want you to do me some glow-in-the-dark corn. Can you do it? Because, I thought it was possible, because I'd read up on it and found out that there was two compounds that they use that react with each other. And he said, "What? I don't fancy doing that. That'll never sell." I says, "Well, how about if I paid you and you just do some for me?" And he says, "Yeah, all right then." And he did, and I tried them, and I had mixed success. Some waters, it was incredible. St. John's, it were fantastic in the winter. It was just ridiculous. And linear. And then other waters, it wasn't so good. And yet other places, that Farlow's, it worked instantly on there. And there was no rhyme or reason except that it didn't do you any harm. You know, it's certainly not a problem. And in recent years, I've been using the yellow, the glow-in-the-dark yellow, and that's been the best one for me. But, you know, I have conversations with people, and a lot of people, again, they won't do that leap of faith where they think, "I'll give it a fair go." They'll put it on for on one rod for a night and go, "Oh, that didn't work." But if you were to put it on every rod and sit with it and try it properly, you'd see that it does work on a lot of places and much more than normal, you know.
I tried it a bit and didn't really get much success, but I remember speaking to a couple of guys that I knew a few years ago. I had a Bundy's winter syndicate. You know how deep that place is?
Yeah,
Bundy's.
That deep, like, one,
64
foot in it in places, yeah.
That's right. And they were using, they reckon the blue one was better than the green one, and had an immense winter using the blue glow-in-the-dark corn on there. Because obviously that's going to be quite dark in the deeper levels in 60 odd foot. They had a load of big ones, and they convinced it was the glow in the dark corn.
Well, I could tell you loads of stories. I remember showing Sean Harrison when I was he was on the mangrove at the time, and I was chatting to him, and I'd got Chris to make me up some boilies as well, halves and full boilies. And I gave Don Harrison, he'd never had an English 40 at the time, and I gave him some of these halves and full boilies, and first time out, he did his first English 40 on one of them glow-in-the-dark ones. And he wrote about it and that, and he went on to use it, and he caught tons on that mangrove. He really did very well on there. And that was his big secret, that he was using the glow-in-the-dark over the top of barrel-shaped boilies and that, you know. And it did work.
At the fishing show, I was watching Paul Garner's underwater bit. I don't know if you could see it off the sonic stand. But,
no, I missed it.
He did quite a lot. He was obviously talking about lure fishing and his go-to lures. He basically uses four colours that cover everything. And then he was taking pictures in, you know, 10-foot of water, 20-foot of water, because he's a diver.
Yeah.
So he's taking underwater pictures looking up. So obviously everything's kind of silhouetted. You know, to a degree. Now it's slightly opposite looking, because we're looking down, you know, we're fishing on the bottom usually, and so carp are looking down towards dark rather than to the light. But you know, he had his kind of go-to colours. But I think it's really interesting, this you know, when you're saying it really made a difference on some waters and not on others, it must just be the clarity and the light spectrum in that particular lake, surely.
It could be something as simple as it might be something to do with the you know, the type of silt on the bottom as well. You know, you might be obscuring them, or something could be not quite right. I don't know, but it's just a fact that it's, I mean, every carp lake there is, them fish in effect are in their own universe. They must just think, I wonder if there's anyone else out there like we do about other solar systems and planets. You know, they don't know what goes on elsewhere. They're in their own little world. So fish will evolve slightly different by the pressure trends that anglers have done on those particular waters. So that might have something to do with it, you know. But I'll tell you one thing that I must remind you of this, Jamie, and this is very interesting, this. Chris tells me about different catch reports, you know, and things, certain occurrences that keep occurring. And he got loads of phone calls off people saying with the glow in the dark that they started having loads of fishing daytime with it.
Yeah,
particularly the green.
Really? That's what they were saying on Bundy's as well. I mean, I just put it down to the fact it was really deep and probably a bit darker down there.
But yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, a glow-in-the-dark green is probably not a lot of difference to them, that really fluorescent green and yellow colour that we use in, you know, in higher track pop-ups. You know, the colour that I mean, you know, it is day glow, isn't it? So the glow-in-the-dark green is probably not a lot of difference to that, I would have thought.
Well, that's the case as well, And another thing I noticed with the plastics is that there's a sort of a day glow lime green. And if every man and his dog's using the yellow, just switch to the green and see what happens with that. Not the sort of racing green, the dark greens. It's the very light one that's like a sort of like Kawasaki sort of green, like that. That's the one. Wow. That's amazing.
One thing Paul said is that quite often, even when you don't think it's there, there's a very fine layer of silt on top of everything. Yeah. Like a lot of the bottoms when he's diving, they've just got this like grey silty colour, you know, no matter if you think you're fishing on orange gravel or whatever, it's, you know, you think on a really smooth gravel spot, he said they're all quite often this dull grey, dark colour.
Yeah.
Which might explain why those brighter colours stand out more.
But, you know, talking about, I've caught loads of fish with the unflavoured, but I've caught many, many more with flavoured. The difference is quite chalk and cheese. I mean, I remember I was doing one of them pro-am things on Horseshoe, and... I was in between this Welsh bloke, Dave, somewhere or other, fancied himself. He'd won a few matches and thought he was the bee's knees. And then I had Paisley on my right, and I'd got a guest with me, you know, and he says, oh, at least I've got a guest this year, so-called celebrity angler. You know, I always laugh when I hear that, because I'm just a normal angler. I don't see myself as a celebrity. It's just a ridiculous sort of connotation. But anyway, he was a boilie man, you know, and he got his sort of 20 mil boilies with him and that. And I was heavily using bag mixes with all kinds of things in them, and the mix would heat up and go warm. It was active. I was using active CSL, corn steep liquor in there, and some other bits and pieces, and yeast again. And so the mix was actually going warm in my hands, and I was putting that in a bag and using two pieces of plastic corn. And if I hadn't had a bite in half an hour, I'd wind it in and change it. And I don't know whether it was because I was refreshing the bag and it had been done, or whether it was because I was putting brand new fresh melon, pineapple flavoured pieces of corn on, but it'd be away. But I had 22 fish. And my mate who was with us, the guest angler, had nothing. It was a bit weird. And Tim Paisley caught one fish and the guy on the left caught nothing. And this ain't to emphasise I'm some big shot or anything. It wasn't. It was just when it clicked and went right. In the end, I thought, matey just sat and watched me have all these fish. And I says, for God's sake, he says, oh, you're casting further than me. I can't possibly cast that far. And I made him switch eventually and he caught some fish. But we came second in that match. And my dear old mate, Steve Watson, won that. You know, that passed away some years ago.
Yeah.
And, he pips us. He was fishing in the snags and had a shed load. But, you know, but that was what made Tim Paisley take notice of the artificial baits. He went, oh, my God, he says, I've really picked something up there, you know, from seeing that. Because I wasn't hiding it or anything, you know. And then he says, you better get us some of them, you know. And, but the interesting thing was, if there weren't a fresh smell on them, they weren't as effective.
Really?
You know? Yeah. Yeah, and I found that loads of places. Just out of interest as well, I mean, I don't just sit back and let Chris Enterprise sort of choose the combinations. I've suggested loads to him. And I, basically, I was messing around. I got this flavour, Rod Hutchinson flavour, and straight away it caught my eye, because I know that a lot of citrus flavours are very attractive to carp. Your orange, lemons, limes, they're acidic inevitably, because a lot of them got essential oils in, and that gives off a big pH signal. And so he had this sublime flavour, it was called, and it smelled like grapefruit, really tangy. I thought, that smells good. I'm going to try that in the plastics. Wow. Wow. Different gravy. Unbelievable. I was putting citric acid in as well, you know.
What's the process of flavouring the plastics? Like, what do you do? Is it just literally soaked?
Literally, it's just exactly that. You just leave them in a pot of pure flavour. I'll sometimes use, sweetener in there a little bit. If some of these flavours, if I feel they're a little bit harsh, I'll try and soften them up a bit. But generally, I use citric acid, they use that to sterilise stuff. It's used in various drinks and beverages, but it's very tangy and acidic. And what that'll do is kill loads of bacteria because it's got pH of 2.5. So I use that with the citric flavours. And as I say, it's just a couple of pieces of plastic corn. So that gives it that monster little signal from two pieces. It's like, poof. And I can wind that particular type of flavour in after 24 hours and I can still smell it as fresh as daylight. The other one is that mulberry Florentine, that lingers. You can have them out for a week and it comes back and it just smells of it, you know. It's one of those very potent flavours. There's one thing about Rod Hutchinson's flavours, that he did have some that just absolutely lingered and stayed. God knows where he got them from, I'd love to know. You know, like the old Nouvelle Fizz and, what was the other one? Autumn Harvest. They just smell like wine gums.
What was the one you used to pour down people's vents on the cars if they pissed you off on a lake? What was that one you used to do?
Oh, mate, we don't even want to be talking about. No, that was Mexican onion oil. Yeah, that's probably not one that we should be mentioning. That's evil.
if somebody kept swiping your peg on the lake, you'd just stick a tub of that down their air vent and they'd have to sell the car.
Yeah.
They'd have to give it away because nobody would buy it.
No, it's worse than that, Jamie. You have to have the car scrapped. You have to have it scrapped. You can't sell it. You can't ever use it again. It's finished. So I think we should maybe cut that out. But
well, to be fair, we've been an hour and a quarter, which is way over where we normally go on the normal interview. If anybody wants to hear a little bit more of Frank's stories, they can go to the Carpcast Extra. Where we've got 6 months worth of stories from that, and we haven't touched on any of the foreign fishing. We've gone deep on bait and singles and stuff in this, which is brilliant. People are going to get a lot from this interview, I think. But we'd love to have you back very soon, I think.
I loved it, Jamie. Yeah, I like having a chat with you and the listeners. It's really nice because it almost feels like you're in the pub with your mates having a chat, you know. And I just hope that they realise that I've not gone into monster detail because, you know, it might get a little bit intense, but this is just skimming over the surface, really. We can go deep and delve at later stages, you know.
We shall do, I think. We'll have this as a test run, Bay, and like I say, we've got tons and tons more that I know we've got to talk about. There's a few more interviews to be had yet, I think. So, but for now, thank you for joining the Carpcast.
You're more than welcome. I'll see you soon, mate.
So if you'd like to hear any more from Frank, then obviously the most obvious thing to do is to go and buy his book. What's it called? Every Bit of Blue?
Yeah.
And you can get that from Angling Publications, no doubt, from Rob Malin's Bounty Hunter Publications. Yeah. Tons of stuff in there.
Cocky Bondu Books do it. They're in Wales. And you can get it from eBay as well. There's a couple of people selling it on there. And... yeah, you can also get it from Amazon also.
Brilliant. Every Bit of Blue. Go and grab yourself a copy for more Frank stories and we'll have you on as soon as we can.
Lovely. Thanks, right. Jamie.
So a big thank you to Frank. We did have him live on the stage with some of his funny stories. And if you want more of Frank, then you can check out the Carpcast Extra, which is available on our website, www.thecarpcast.com. There's loads of stuff on there. There's a few articles from myself and Mark. There's a little bit of a biography about Mark and myself, how we got to this point in our angling career. But more importantly, you can subscribe to support the podcast. It's $4.99 a month or £35 for a year, which is an absolute bargain. That's like £2.80 a month or something. And you get extra content, which is all stories. It's not opinions or gossip or news. It's basically all stories or tactical stuff. We have an in-session feature on there as well. And it's people seem to really like it. They're always 3 hours long at least. And like I say, they come out monthly. They come out on the last Friday of every month, all being well. And it's just a way to support this podcast and keep this podcast free forever. Keep the normal one. We aim to do 4 a month, minimum. Sometimes there's 5. But there will always be 4 every month. And these will stay free. But we do hope that you support us. People were asking us if they could donate, you know, to keep this going, because the people that really like it seem to really like it. So instead of people just giving us or donating money for nothing to support the podcast, we said, right, well, what can we do to give you something back if you would like to donate? Okay, we'll give you some extra content. And how we've done it a series of stories that we've asked famous anglers. We've got Frank Warwick on there. We've got Ronnie de Groter, famous Belgium angler. We've got Kevin Nash, we've got Alan Blair, Daryl Peck, John McAllister. We're adding to them all the time as well. And we just basically asked them their favourite stories about certain topics that we gave them. And there's some absolute belters on there. This month, what did we do? We did scary stories, didn't we? And then there's some supernatural stuff on there. John Mack's an absolute belter about an out-of-this-world experience on a lake down in Essex or Kent, I think it was. I won't spoil it for you because it's a must listen. It's an amazing story. And Frank Warwick telling the story about the nightmare swim on Reedsmere, from an actual real nightmare that happened in there, a story of somebody unfortunately dying in the lake. And I won't ruin it for you, but there's some cracking stories on there. So if you would like to subscribe to support us, www.thecarpcast.com, you can make an account on there anyway, just to, which costs nothing. It just means you get newsletters and if there's any gossip that we can tell. But there's also a shop on there where you can buy our Carpcast hoodies, t-shirts and hats as well. They're all really high quality ones. They're not the super cheap dead thin stuff. It's really nice woolly hats. It's got the Carp Cast on them. We have one of our favourite sayings, "The Carp Gods Giveth," on a t-shirt. And we have a really nice hoodie with Carp Cast logo and stuff on the back. Go and check them out on the website. Again, it's just another way to support us, and they are really good quality hoodies, t-shirts and hats and stuff. Quite a few people bought them at Northern Angling Show, but you can get them on the website. You can subscribe to you can join one of our Carpcast coaching socials on the website as well. There's a button where you can now just pay for that, or if you'd like to pay for installments, you can just contact us. You get in touch with Mark Watson on Facebook.
Yep.
Or at Scaly Beast, is it, on Twitter?
It is. I should change that. It's a bit embarrassing.
or there is a Carpcast Twitter account as well. The way the socials work, we've hired some lakes throughout the year. We've got Kevin Nash's Royston Lake in August, which is exclusive access to that before it opens as a day ticket. It's stuffed full of fish. There's two lakes there. I think we've got 25 places in total available on there. We've got Lynch Hills Christchurch in October. Is there any places left on the Cromwell one, the first one?
There is, but there's also quite a bit of interest at the minute. I've had a few messages asking for information, so if you are considering the Cromwell, get in touch sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I think there's only...
Robin has just landed on me rods. Give me a look.
I think there was only two places on Cromwell last week, was it? And you said there's a few inquiries, Gemmell. You can book directly on the website. What we basically do is you get our company for the weekend on a fantastic lake. We've handpicked the lakes we want to fish on. All got loads of 30s, 40s in, and potentially 50s, a couple of them. And you get to fish with us, you get to pick our brains for the weekend, we feed you, we'll get Chinese or Indian on the Friday night. We have www.firedupbarbecues doing the Saturday night food, which if you're looking for any, if you've got an event or you want somebody to come and do you an amazing barbecue, for any do that you're at, then check out their website, www.firedupbarbecues.co.uk. They have a Facebook page as well, Fired Up Barbecues. There's links to that on our page, and they're going to come and do a right nice little barbecue-y social that they set up, like gazebos, and have, you know, so it's cool if it's raining, and have a decent food set up. So we're supplying that on the Saturday night as well. We'll supply all the beers for the Saturday night, so we can have a bit of a social and a drink. And we also have a guest angler down as well, a celebrity guest as well, who will spend a bit of time with everybody coaching. The Cromwell one, we've got Julian Cundiff coming down there, so you can fish with Julian and ourselves. All your tickets are included in the price for the lake. I know on the Baden Hall one is Terry Edmonds doing casting coaching, so if you want to learn how to cast a bit better or learn how one of the world record holders does it, then you can book the Royston one. Have we got someone booked in for Christchurch? I can't remember now.
Don't think we have yet. We've got a couple of names that's bandied around, but
yeah, I thought I'd spoke to somebody. I'm going to have to check my emails. I won't say who it is in case it's wrong, but I think I might have booked somebody for that.
Yeah.
Alan Blair's coming on the Nash Royston one, so if you ever wanted to fish with Urban Bank star Alan Blair, then the Royston one is the one for you. That's extremely popular, that one, because it's going to be access to a brand new day ticket lake owned by Kevin Nash, and it'll be before anyone else gets a chance to fish it. It's in the middle of nowhere as well. We maybe have a bit of a party on the Saturday night because it's my birthday on the Sunday, so that looks like being great fun, that one. Lots and lots of interest, but yeah, you can get details, or you can pay for that on the website, or you can contact Mark and he'll set up some sort of deposit and payment scheme. It's £250 per person for Friday to Sunday, coaching included with us, all your food included, beers on the Saturday night, and obviously the late tickets included as well. Hopefully you'll come away learning something, or maybe you just want to come for the crack with us.
Jaffa cakes included too.
Oh yeah, we'll supply Jaffa cakes. So yeah, that's all good. Again, the dates are on the website, www.thecarpcast.com. It's almost wrapped it up today, except...
I'm going to give a shout-out to our friends at Carp Talk.
Yeah, you've not told us what's in this week's Carp Talk. There's a Carp Talk Extra... Carp Talk online version that comes out on a Saturday. It's now Tuesday. You're probably going to get this Tuesday evening, which is when the printed copy comes out in the shops. What's in this week's version, Mark?
In this week, wow, 5 welly carp, Wellington Country Park carp, over 47, including 250s.
That wow, place is
we really need.
Yeah, we spoke about it a lot at the minute.
Yeah, but he just keeps making the news and more. And it's not in this week, for I know Ian Stotts had a 59 as well.
Ian Stotts had a 50 in, was it November, December, January and February? We're on the 1st of March today, 2nd of March. So he's got himself 30 days to do 6 months in a row of 50s, which is unreal. But yeah, what a stock that place has got. But yeah, there's all the lowdown on Welly in there. What else is in there?
The story of a chap who dropped down on Strawberry Fields for his first visit and had a 47 and a 57. Wow, all these big fish. Wow, a new 50 from Cambridge Avenue, Home Fen. I mean, that's only been open about a year as well. And that is absolutely stuffed full of companies. They also, what we've touched upon, the bait tackle thing. There's quite an interesting article from there. And then other features. Neil Spooner tells you how to re-spool the boat properly. Got Dale Turner. He talks to us all about zig fishing, and we've got Trade Talk. Got the new. I think we've got this in the shop. Pacific Tuna from CC Moore. That does smell really, really nice. We've got Nash Scope stuff, liquids, water boots, and ESP gear, Paragon Plus landing nets.
I've seen there's a competition in there this week as well for £250 worth of the Summit Tackle Cobalt Black Buzz Bars and Bank Sticks. I saw those at the Anglin Show as well at the weekend. I know Roger treated himself to £300 worth. I know Spenny, one of our partners, treated himself to a few hundred quids worth. Their gear looks ace. I really do like the look of their black stainless with the, like, the big screw threads on the bottom, and everything about those Summit Tackle equipment, it looks fantastic to me. So I'm too tight to spend £300 in a load of stainless, but I'm quite happy to tell everybody how good it is. If you want to send me some, Mr. Summit, but I'm going to be buying Carb Talk this week because they've got a competition for £250 worth, so I will definitely be entering that. I think you can get the online version of Carb Talk. It comes out every Saturday. The digital version only costs £1.49. It's available from pocketmags.com. You can view it on your Apple, Android or PC. The print version comes out today on a Tuesday and every Tuesday, and there's a stockist locator on the Carp Talk website, so go to the Carp Talk website and find out where you can buy it from, order it from your local shop, or just use pocketmags.com to view on your device, and that'll do us, I think.
Yeah, I was hoping to do an Adam Tenin and catch one. This is about the time right at the end, but I don't think it's going to happen. And fallen landed at a random drop back. That's all we're getting.
Well, I hope when we do Saturday's edition, you tell us you had that take while the rods were on the floor and all the gear was in the motor. Last chance saloon, but you've got another hour or two, haven't you? So
yeah.
And the weather's just got mild, isn't it?
Well, I tell you what, I'm looking over to my spots now, and the sun's on it. There's a nice warm ripple blowing in. It's got to be at least 11, 12 degrees, if not more. And, you know, if I only need to see one or two fish jump, and I'm on the phone for another night and getting covered work tomorrow.
Yeah, phone in sick. See a fish show, phone in sick. That's how we do it.
Yeah. Have you ever phoned in sick and then caught?
Yeah, whenever I've took a day off, whenever I've, like, missed work, cancelled plans, done something to stay an extra night on the bank, it's never paid off. Not once, ever, in all the years. So I should just go home and bite the bullet.
Me neither. Yeah, but anyway, first session, learnt a lot, enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a great lake, isn't it? You will be seeing one or both of us on Swan Lake, on the Kingfisher Complex at some point during this year. Until Saturday, we'll catch you later.
Check out the website at thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.